House Committee on Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy to order. Welcome back. It feels a little different to be in the hearing rooms again, but it's good to see a lot of the same faces, and great to see, well, Representative Nelson, maybe, unless we have another meeting, this will be our last meeting with her. Yeah. So today we have three presentations, and we are going to introduce a piece of legislation. And because Representative from down the coast there has to leave early, we're going to do that first. We're just going to take a little bit out of, so Lindsay, you can cool your jets a little bit, and we'll take our action first, since we only have one, and it's going to be fairly quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Apologies for needing to be somewhere else today, too.
Representative Callan is, we're so glad she's here, but we're sorry she's leaving. Okay, I will gavel in a work session. We have LC, I guess I could put my glasses on, that would help. LC 1216, and this is, once again, the seafloor mapping bill. We're reintroducing this, and I'm going to let Sandy read it for you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 1216, dated September 5th, 2008, is appropriating money from the general fund to the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries for Oregon Territorial Map Sea Mapping Project at Oregon State University. It does have an emergency clause that if it passes, it will be effective July 1, 2009. Obviously, this appropriates money, so no matter what committee it goes to, it'll go to Ways and Means ultimately, Madam Chair.
And I just wanted to say, explain again why we're doing this. We didn't get this last time for various reasons, but there has been much conversation about this issue subsequently, and more people have realized how important it is. And I'll just reiterate a couple of the reasons why we want to do it, but there may be more, too. And one is to work, now that we have active LIDAR mapping going on, and in some cases close to finish. Yeah, we have Dogami's represented here, and she might be able to fill us in on that later. But we have, with the LIDAR and the bathymetric mapping, we can make a credible tsunami model. We can use it for marine research purposes, update navigational charts, which is important because some of them date back to the 1800s. And if I were going out to sea, I would want a more updated chart for my boat. But I don't go to sea, so. But I do care about my constituents and the rest of the people in Oregon who do. And we just think this is something that we should do in Oregon. It should happen. And once it's there, we have the best lab in the world at Oregon State University, knows what they're doing. We actually had a couple of opportunities this past summer. Some ships from California came up, and had we had the money and had my visa not maxed out so badly, I would have done it myself. And they offered us the time, basically, and that was it was about half price, basically. So,
wow.
But they were going to be here transitioning between California and Washington State to do mapping up there, too. So anyway, missed opportunity, but the Oregon State people are still down there, and they're still working hard. And they have also put some stuff up on interactive database on the web. So with that, I would like to open up. Anybody else have a comment about this?
Madam Chair. Okay. Hopefully I can now talk.
I'm sorry about that.
I was kind of giving you
exercise
here.
Over here. I'm glad
because
you
said it all since I couldn't get all that out. But I would like to just second what you were saying about the renewed interest in this particular bill. I'm hearing it in a whole variety of places. And as folks come to the coast and do some tours and start thinking about things, I've heard fellow legislators say, oh, didn't we talk about that? What was that again? Do you remember what it was? Oh, yes, I do remember what it was. So I think there's actually some additional interest, and it's critically important to the overall complexity of the ocean policy issues that we're trying to coordinate and line up and do some collective thinking about. So I think it's very important that we put some energy behind this one this time.
And I guess I have to say, she didn't mention it by name, but one of the big issues that we're dealing with up on the coast is marine reserves. And tomorrow is the final day for applications or nominations for placement of marine reserves. And it's been my thought all along is that we really need to have mapping so that we know what's going on, at least underneath some of these proposed places. So, well, with that, I will ask for
the vote.
A motion,
excuse me.
Madam Chair.
I was hoping that she was going to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me this very last opportunity in my legislative career to move.
The very last action.
Wow. And as I do so move, I would like to say, had Oregon State not done so well in football, I would not have felt them competent to do this. I'm just kidding.
That's good.
We know that.
Yeah. All right. Go Beavers.
Go Beavers.
But anyway, I forgot how to do this. But anyway, I move that we...
LC 1216
be introduced as a committee bill in this upcoming legislature.
Thank you. Is there a second?
We don't need one,
but I'll give you one.
Okay. Well, I'm giving everybody a chance here. This is your chance. It's been moved and seconded. It's been moved and not seconded to introduce this 1216 as a committee bill. And all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. So be it. And I will close the work session on seafloor mapping bill LC 1216 and reopen the informational meeting. I'll call up Lindsay Ball, director of OWIN, Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, to give an update and status report. Welcome, Lindsay. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Chair Boone, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Ball. I work for Governor Kulongoski, and I'm assigned to the OWIN project. Since we last met, there have been several things that have taken place with the OWIN project. And to kind of give everyone a reminder, it is a statewide interoperable public safety radio communications network for the state of Oregon. It is based on a land mobile radio concept. It will be P25 digital with a microwave backbone. Now, P25 digital is the radio component, and the microwave backbone is the microwave that will be built around the state that will do the data and radio transfer as the backbone of the system. What has occurred last week at the emergency board is there was limitation approved for the build-out of the microwave backbone in the western 18 counties of Oregon. The map that you have before you, as they say, pictures are worth a thousand words. It illustrates the backbone network that will be built out and completed at the end of the $76 million expenditure. We will then come forward with a recommendation for a radio build-out, which will be P25-based, which is a universal method of communication, radio communication in the United States. And what is very fairly unique about Oregon, and I hope that I'm going to go through a list of some things that Oregon is doing differently than what other states are doing. I think it's important for us to note this. In 2005, when the legislature passed House Bill 2101 that would consolidate the four radio networks in the state with Department of Transportation, Department of Corrections, State Police, and Forestry, they directed that the state consolidate those radio systems, but they also requested that there be interoperability in the state. Now, that is somewhat unique because what we've seen around the United States is that the states are building out radio systems in a consolidated fashion, but they're not particularly building them in an interoperable way. And so Oregon has taken two steps in one here. They're consolidating and building out a network, but they're also requiring it to be interoperable with local government and federal government and tribal government, which I think is very wise on our behalf. And I think it will be more efficient. In conjunction with that, we've also taken that to the next step, And we have entered into a partnership agreement with the City of Portland in the Tri-County area, as well as Clark County, Washington. Now, this is the first that we know in the nation that we've been able to identify with, a first statewide system that has incorporated a large metropolitan public safety radio communication system as well. Typically, the state will build a system, but it's not integrated into the large metropolitan areas of their state. Now, giving an example of how we will accomplish that with the City of Portland, what we've entertained is installing what is called a controller in the system, which would allow the City of Portland to use the state system, and it would also allow the state to use the city's system. And that doubles up our capacity. And as we've all discussed between Owen and the Tri-County and the Portland metro area, if there is a disaster, and there will be, I can assure you of that, when there is that disaster, we recognize that the city's system will not be able to, will not have the capacity to handle the volume of traffic, and that they will be able to easily convert and utilize the state system. And conversely, we will be able to do the same. If our system becomes overburdened, we would be able to use the city system as well. And so we're able to double our system with least cost to either the City of Portland and the Tri-County area, as well as the state. So that speaks well of how we've started looking at ways that we can partner and economize the Owen project. Which brings me to a point I think is extremely important, and I think we need to focus on this as we think about the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. The cornerstone of this is partnerships. Of the 18 western counties in the state of Oregon, we now have 33 sharing partnerships, with cities and counties, and I think that speaks well of the spirit here in Oregon. Certainly in the context I've had with communication specialists around the United States, we are a first with respect to those types of partnerships. We certainly don't see it on the East Coast, and I was talking to a couple of vendors last week who have contracts around the United States, and they have not seen anything similar to Oregon. And I can say that every local government, city and county government that I've contacted to be a partner, I have not had anyone turn us down, and people have come forward in a very enthusiastic way. And we're not dictating what type of a radio system they have. We're not telling them that they have to buy a certain brand of radio or a certain frequency. What we're doing is we're asking, would you like to share the infrastructure that we're building out, towers and buildings and radio sites? And conversely, they, much like the state, have found themselves in a situation where they are going to be having to build out radio systems in order to meet the federal mandate by 2013. And so it's a win-win for both of us. And years ago, in my previous experience working as a state police officer in the Fish and Wildlife Division, I oftentimes went to mountaintops to help transport radio repair folks or whatever, mostly because we had four-wheel drive pickups. But it always amazed me, this goes back 35 years ago, why we would have a tower for the county sheriff, a tower for the county road department, a tower for Department of Transportation, a tower for forestry, a tower for state police. And we'd have five and six towers at a site, and really we can put all those on one site and share a common infrastructure. And that's what's very attractive to a lot of our local governments. And so we can do away with that five and six towers on top of a hill. We can put up one. The other thing that we've done, too, in Oregon is we've opened the door to private business. If they want to share a site with us, we have given them all the latitude and longitude sites or numbers for our sites so that they can start comparing their need in the future for their build out to see if they can partner with us. And we've also looked at some of their sites where we can possibly share a common site with them. So once again, I just want to emphasize that partnerships are the cornerstone of the Olin project, in my estimation. Another thing that we did since the February 2008 session, when we did have a chance to converse about this and inform you on the topic, another thing that we did was we took a look at what the 700 megahertz spectrum, how it performs and how it propagates a radio signal from towers. I'll give you a little bit of an idea of what has taken place. The state of Colorado put in a 700 megahertz system over their former VHF system. And today, so you kind of put this in comparison, the Oregon system, for the most part, works on VHF frequencies. Now, VHF has been a standard among public safety agencies and many other entities for many, many years. It's performed very well. But with the competition for bandwidth and frequencies, the demand and interference is being created. Demand for frequencies creates interference in the VHF arena, and it's not as conducive to clear communications as it once was. And Oregon has an opportunity to move to a 700 megahertz system, which was authorized by the Federal Communications Commission. But here was the catch with 700. It was believed that we would have to build out 30% more towers and sites if we went to 700 than if we stayed with VHF. As I mentioned, there's all kinds of difficulties with VHF and competition for frequencies and bandwidth in VHF. But what we were hearing from the state of Colorado in an anecdotal way was their 700 was performing very well. Now, they hadn't done a test or anything to be able to prove that. It was just by use of the public safety servants in that state that were commenting that it seemed to work better than they anticipated. And so what I did was I asked, well, has anyone done a test? I mean, someone surely has compared VHF to 700. And come to find out, no one had. And in the $665 million figure that everyone was shocked at when we rolled that out about a year ago, there was a 30% build-out requirement in that cost associated with 700. So you would have to build 30% more towers and buildings. So what we did was we invested some money, hired a private engineering company, and we tested VHF against 700. So you can kind of visualize this. To get an accurate test, you put the antenna of the 700 and the VHF on top of a tower at the same location, at the same height. So you get a good propagation of radio wave from it. And then you take a vehicle and you drive over that geographic area. And it's all computerized. And so it sends a signal, the computer tracks it, plots it on a map, and it shows you the exact coverage area comparing 700 with VHF. Well, what we started finding out about the third day of the test was, and the test took place up in Clatsop County, at Nikolai Mountain, Wilson Butte on Highway 6 above Tillamook, and also Maegler across on the western side shooting back into Oregon. What we found on the third day was there was very little difference between 700 and VHF, 3 to 5% difference at most. And once we got done with the tests in those three sites, which took about a month to do, we then decided to try it in a more open area, and so we went to Pendleton, where we have some wide expanses of area without a lot of forests or mountains, and we found that it performed as well there as it did in Northwest Oregon as well. And so 700 performed very, very satisfactorily. we feel that that is now an option to explore, so that we would have one frequency in the state of Oregon and one radio instead of having to buy two and three different types of radios, thereby saving more money, which is a good thing. And if you kind of visualize today, the way we get interoperability is, in some instances, we have as many as seven radios in a car, in a patrol car. And if you want to put that into a real-life application, say we're on I-5 and we have an attempt to elude and you're going from one jurisdiction to the next and through different radio towers into different frequency bands, and you're sitting there driving 120 miles an hour and you're trying to turn the radio to a different channel or figure out which of the seven mics you should pick up to talk to, it becomes a little bit of a trial for the person operating the car at the same time. Whereas if we can go to 700, say, for instance, you have one radio, you just pick up one mic and start talking.
Lindsay, are you telling me that state troopers drive 120 miles an hour?
There have been times,
while they're talking on their cell phones.
As long as they're not texting.
Well, I haven't seen them talking on cell phones. But that does, it does put that in perspective.
Yeah. Rep. Cowan.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but I'm trying to track here, and I'm not sure I fully understood. You had talked about the 30% of the big number cost for build-out for additional towers, and then when you were talking about the testing you've done of the 700 system, are you saying that the tests were positive enough that we're not going to need the build-out of new towers, or could put that into the existing ones? I'm sorry, I'm not technical enough to follow
okay.
all that.
Chair Boone, Representative Cowan, what this means is when we were quoted the $665 million, if we were going to go to a 700 system, we would have to add 30% more towers to what we currently have. What the test did for us was it illustrated that we can use, for the most part, the existing towers that we have and not have to have a 30% build-out.
Okay.
So in other words, take 30% off the price tag of the 700 hybrid system. And we can use, for the most part, the current system we have for radio sites.
Okay.
Which is a savings, because if you stop to think about it, each tower that you put up costs about $500,000.
Right. Okay. So you don't think we're going to have to do that amount of build-up?
No.
Thank you.
I think we've turned the corner on that. We've had other private vendors associated with us in that test, and we've also sent that out for peer review. That study was done so it would be publishable quality. We checked and rechecked to make sure that we weren't in error. And I feel very comfortable about the results of that test.
Rep. Shonfler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This concept, Lindsay, I've told you before, it's a no-brainer. I really like the redundancy part, and you can go, city can use ours or we can use theirs. And on your map here, I actually have several questions here. You got Scott Mountain. Is that Mount Scott there in Clackamas County, northern Clackamas County? Is that the Scott Mountain?
Chair Boone, Representative Shoffer, that is correct.
Yeah, everybody in our neighborhood calls it Mount Scott. And the towers are actually in Happy Valley.
Where is that?
It's in Happy Valley, just east of the town center on 205.
Happy Valley.
Okay. And then in our conversations in the past, some legislators were in need of more specifics on what we were going to spend and how much we were going to spend it on. And have you satisfied all those questions of more specifics on how we were going to spend our money and where? And where are you at right now in your funding as far as how much money you have?
What took place last week in the emergency board was they approved $76 million of limitation, scheduling about $26.5 million of that for expenditure. They asked that we come back to the December e-board as well as to the Ways and Means Committee early in the session to report back on our progress, at which time they would approve scheduling the $49.5 million that they've held. In other words, everyone wants to make sure that we're progressing in a manner that is reasonable, and I have no problem with that.
Right.
I think that's a very wise decision, and so that we can continue the discussion.
Well, I'm glad. May I follow up, Madam Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
As far as the seven mics, I can just see Barney Fife driving down the road a bunch of cords. That's kind of what I envisioned there. So I really like the idea that you're narrowing it down, yet it's actually more availability for people. And then I was talking to some firefighters several years ago about line of sight versus another technology. I think you're touching on that with the 700 VHF. I'm not sure, but the system they were complaining about in Clackamas County was the same as in Chicago, and I've asked you this question before. Chicago's flat, Clackamas County's mountainous, and they were kind of frustrated that they had that system and they had a better system, they felt. Is that something along the lines of what you're talking about, the 700 versus VHS, and whether they work or not in mountainous areas? You're talking a different language here when you talk about all this technology, so you just want to clarify that for me a little bit.
Chair Boone, Representative Schaffler, the VHF has had a reputation for many years as being a better performer in a mountainous, forested type areas. 700 reportedly did not do as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we discovered in the test that we conducted, if you take a look at the strict behavior of the wavelength itself, 700 does not perform as well as VHF. But when you have a digital 700 system, as we're proposing, and you test it on what is referred to as the bit error rate, which had never been done before.
What? Excuse me?
A bit error rate.
Okay.
See, what happens for the most part when you have a digital system, you're putting a computer in front of the radio, and the computer picks up the signal, it shapes it, reshapes it, and delivers it. And so there's a certain error rate that the computer will fix for you that you won't get out of, say, a non-digital system. And so what we did was we compared the bit error rate to the VHF, and we found that in 700, the digital portion of that system would reconfigure it so it would be strong enough signal that it would come out as an audible voice over the radio. So, in other words, what we were able to illustrate, which had never been done anywhere in the world, by the way, I hope you can appreciate this.
Yeah.
Oregon kind of set the stage with a lot of vendors in saying, look, this does work.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, one more, please. So then the communities that have got this system will be able to go back and retrofit their systems to take advantage of this technology you're talking about to make it better in the mountainous areas if they already have that system that wasn't considered as effective. Is that, am I correct in thinking that?
Chair Boone, Representative Schaffer, it all depends on what type of radio frequency they desire to have and what systems they may want to pursue. What the test that we conducted was just comparing 700 to VHF. And 700 is set aside specifically for public safety. VHF isn't. And we have to license each frequency band that we use in VHF for the state of Oregon. If we were to go to 700 or go to VHF today and reconfigure it to meet our needs, one of the first things we would need to do would be to hire a frequency coordinator to ensure that we placed frequencies in VHF that didn't interfere with other people or other license holders interfere with us just because of the range on the VHF. Of course, 700 is pretty straightforward. It has a certain specific distance that it extends out to and then it falls off, which is exactly what you want in a system that we're talking about statewide and in installation.
Thank you.
Okay.
I feel very comfortable about where we are.
Representative Nielsen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Ball. It's kind of ironic that each one of these megahertz costs $1 million. Right? Would you agree? 700 megahertz and a $665 million bill.
Okay.
Right?
The megahertz.
Isn't that interesting? Okay. So much for trivia. But you talked about 18 western counties. I can't identify 18 western counties on this map. And I see only 7 counties without some connection to your program. Could you help me there?
What the counties, if I can remember, if you want me to walk through all of them, I can do that.
For do the you have this map, excuse
yes,
me,
I do.
In front of you?
For the most part, the counties in the $76 million category take from the summit of the Cascades to the coast. And with Deschutes and Klamath County on this in Central Oregon included. Now, the sum of what you have on the map is a build out that we've already funded in cooperation with the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission, U.S. Department of Justice, and also community oriented policing grants. And so you see on your map a line that goes from Portland out to Pendleton. That's a partnership with Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Enforcement and Commission. From the Dalles to Bend over to Salem, that loop is funded by community-oriented policing grants. And the line that you see down the I-5 corridor came from the Integrated Wireless Network with the U.S. Department of Justice. The rest of it would entail the $76 million.
So just three follow-ups. Because the reason I'm really concerned is because the radio communication system in Yamhill County has been, you know, besides the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, the top two issues in my county. And do you include us, or is Yamhill County part of your network?
Chair Boone, Representative
Nelson.
Is
it one of the 18?
Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, yes. We have a signed partnership agreement with Yamhill County.
Oh, that makes me feel great.
And also, County Commissioner Kathy George is a member of the SIEC Council.
Great. Good. And just a quick last one. When we're talking about, you know, emergency preparedness, I'm concerned, you mentioned the state of Washington, but what about Idaho, California? Are they on the same 700 system? So in the event that we have a massive evacuation because of a tsunami to these other states, will they be able to communicate with us? Or are they as keen on your 700 system as you are?
Chair Boone, Representative Nelson. No, we can't dictate to the other state what frequencies that they wish to use.
Well, are they?
And you will find that they are not.
They're not on
700. They may choose to go to 700 sometime, but they have a different. Each state has a different radio network.
So they're not keen on this.
Just like each county and city has a different radio network, and for the most part, it will probably be VHF. We do have a couple of 800 systems in the state. Portland is one, as well as Bend.
And may I just ask a financial question? And does Metro kick in some bucks on this network for us, or do we just mark it off because we can share systems?
Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, one of the things that we've discussed with the Tri-County, that's Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas County, as well as the City of Portland and Metro, is that they allow us access to their microwave system, all of their buildings, and their towers. And in exchange for that, we provide the controller that would allow them to use our system and for us to use their system.
So it's reciprocity without dollars.
Right. And if you want a price tag as to what sharing by what savings are associated with that partnership,
I would like it.
You're looking at excess of $35 million.
All right. Okay. Sounds good.
Rep. Callen.
Thank you. Because I'm not a member of the emergency board, and I'm not quite remembering all of the numbers in this whole thing, could you kind of run through the financials inform me at this point. I mean, we're talking about a $700 million system. We're talking about the $76 million. Where are we in this funding process, and what are we looking for at this point?
Chair Boone, Representative Callan, maybe I can help you with that by giving you our estimated costs of the system as we see it today. The $665 million figure was what was projected cost associated with the study that was done by Federal Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very thorough study. I've looked at it many times. And just to kind of give you a point of reference, from that, they identified and documented that 80% of the infrastructure in the radio system in the state of Oregon today needs to be replaced. So just kind of, that just kind of gives you an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in looking at the $665 figure, by doing more work within the state of Oregon with staff that we have, as well as partnerships, we projected that we could reduce that cost from $665 million to about $405 million. Now, this is one thing I want to make sure everyone understands very clearly. Those numbers are very fluid.
Understand.
We have no idea what the next partnership will bring us with respect to savings or cost, nor do we have a good handle on what inflation may do with construction costs, metal, steel, builds all the towers, etc. Those things are all a moving target. And so the one thing I can guarantee you is those numbers will change.
Sure.
Thank you.
Rep.
Sheffler?
But help me with the request that was on the table with the emergency board and what we're going to be looking at in the next session in terms of where we are in this process.
Chair Boone, Representative Callan, what we requested from the from the emergency board was $76 million limitation so we could build out the towers, the buildings, and the digital microwave for the western half of Oregon, 18 counties.
I think so. That was not granted at this point, was it? Or just help me stay up to date here.
Okay. Chair Boone, Representative Callan, the emergency board approved the limitation for expenditure of the $76 million.
Okay.
They scheduled $26.5 million of that, asking that we come back at the December e-board and early in the 09 session in Ways and Means to report on our progress.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
And at that time, they would then consider scheduling the other $49.5 million.
Okay.
There are some things that they would like to see, which I don't have any disagreement with at all with, such as a project management office within the Owen project, Q&A, etc. We have those things started, but without funding, I can't hire people and contract out people, and so we now can start that progress and process, and hopefully I can come back in December and early in the session with those people on staff and a product to deliver to the legislature.
Thank you. I apologize for being a step behind, but I was trying to track all these things.
No, that's perfectly all right.
Yep.
In fact, the county that you reside in, Representative, is a very pivotal point in this whole system. And we've found Lincoln County, as other counties, to be very enthusiastic. The one thing that kind of touches me about Lincoln County was, as the system was being brought forth, there were the northwest seven counties and the southwest seven counties. And I'll never forget the day I got a call from Sheriff Dotson, and he said, Lindsay, what about us? And I says, I'm going to get to you. and they've been very cooperative. In fact, beg your pardon?
Lincoln County. We were that pivotal missed middle county.
Right. You're in no man's land for a while. And we had to get you inside the fence, so to speak. But there are two sites in Lincoln County that are that really improved communications tremendously for both the state and the local folks. I think we can do very well by that partnership agreement.
Okay. I'm sorry, I put a shuffler in front of you.
Mr. Ball, do we have any federal funds coming?
Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, that question's come up several times. It came up at an emergency board, and let me give you a bit of an idea of the revenue that has been generated by the sale of bandwidth by Federal Communications Commission recently, and then potential money that will be generated by the sale of the D block of what is called 700. Now, all these numbers, I'm sure, probably a little bit confusing to you, but what it amounts to is the Federal Communications Commission is offering bandwidth for sale. Now, let me give you a little bit of a hint as to why that is, and I think you'll recognize it. The demand for bandwidth, radio bandwidth, in the United States is at an all-time high. And if you stop and think about it, all of your wireless communication that has been developed in the last 15 years with your cell phones, your computers, and all that is eating up bandwidth. And so the demand from the commercial side is quite high for more and more bandwidth. Yeah. And that's why they're going from wideband to the narrowband requirement. And that's one of the reasons we have to overhaul our system, because Oregon is still wideband, and we have to change that to narrowband by 2013. So there's a demand by society for more bandwidth. Now, they sold bandwidth about 5 months ago, 6 months ago now, and they picked up $19.1 billion for selling that.
Now, $19.1 billion.
Now the sale of the 700 D block is going to come up for auction here in the near future. There were some difficulties around that. They didn't get the minimum bid that they wanted to in the first round, and so they changed some of the requirements, and it'll go out for bid. When I was back in Washington, D.C., last December, when I first was assigned to this task, I went around and I met with members of the congressional delegation and talked to them about opportunities for federal funding, knowing that that there was an impending auction of the bandwidth. That's what the $19.1 billion was. And so I said, is there any way, since the requirement is we go from wideband to narrowband, that we can get some money from the federal government to help the states? Also recognizing that in the last couple of years, we've seen federal dollars that come to the states for interoperability start to diminish, and they're projected to diminish more and more. And honestly, they looked at me and where have you been? We have a war, and that's where the money's going. And they said there would be no option for the states to pick up any money. That would go into the state or the federal treasury and be spent. So there is no cash cow, so to speak, from the federal government to help with this at this time.
And follow up, not even in Homeland Security dollars?
No, in fact, Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, those dollars are diminishing as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, considering some of our federal decisions, I think some of these guys should be sent and put in D block. A different D block, though. I was going to thank you for asking. The Homeland Security question was one of my questions. I think the metro regional government that the good representative referred to my knowledge, they don't provide any emergency response at all, do they? Does anybody know the answer to that question? I don't believe they do. But on the sharing, you said $35 million. That's going to come from local governments. Did I get that right?
No. Chair Boone, Representative Shoffler, if we were to put our system inside Portland, it would cost us about that much money, approximately.
And you're going to but you'll be able to use theirs in case something. That's the beauty of having this all.
Chair Boone, Representative Shoffler, what Portland has extended is that they will let us come in and install our equipment in their buildings and put our antennas on their towers.
Right.
And let us ride their microwave.
Okay.
Now, if we had to go into Portland and build our own site, you're talking lots of money, and you would probably exceed $500,000 a tower. And just because of the complexity of the Portland area.
Yeah, and you know,
so it's a savings to us.
Well, and that's what I want. That's what I was trying to get at there. You know, the fact that we're so far out in front here, it begs the question: why haven't we done this a long time ago? The fact that you have to have all those frequency managers and all this stuff, and you can a lot of the things. If you go with the system, it'll continue to have redundancy and actually eliminate a lot of extra stuff and extra work and confusion. But my question is, let's say in Shanico their tower falls down, will Grizzly Mountain still be able to communicate with Hulsey Ranch? Is that how this works? So you can go back.
Yeah, it's Hulsey Ranch.
Hulsey Ranch.
It's up on top of Ty Ridge. If you've been down in that area, Ty Ridge is quite a high point. What takes place in the system, the way it's built, if you look, you can see that there are loops.
Right, that's where it is.
Those loops, those little circles, provide interconnection between that within that system. So if a tower goes down, what happens is automatically the equipment is set up so it reverses the signal and runs it back the other way. And so, in a sense, all that you do is you may lose the one site, but you don't lose the whole system. Now, if you take a look at the leg that goes from Portland to Pendleton, it doesn't have a loop. And on your map, and if we lose one site, everything downstream from that site we lose. And so, the loop configuration is extremely important. And in the next phase of Owen, we would start looking at how we would close that loop that goes out to Pendleton in this system. And that's why the partnerships have been very important to us, like in Southwest Oregon, working with the Southwest counties, we have a loop that goes over to Coos Bay and back up the coast and hooks back into Eugene, which is very, very important. And then with the loop that comes from Bend to Klamath to Medford, that's just as important.
Now, is that money, was there federal money that Representative or Congressman DeFazio got? Is that what paid for part of that, or is that something completely different?
Chair Boone, you're correct. That is exactly what took place. Representative DeFazio was able to earmark some money for Southwest Seven Counties, his congressional district.
Okay.
And what they did, once they learned how this all kind of started rolling out, if everyone will recall, we were focused on the Northwest Seven Counties. They came forth to us and said, we have $9 million we want to invest, but we've also recognized that we're losing our federal timber tax money. We don't have the funds to own or operate such a system. So let's leverage our money and pool our money, and we'll build the leg of the loop on the coast. You build the one on I-5, and then we will have a loop that ties together, and let's work out a deal as to where we can utilize the system. And so that's worked very, very well. That's the partnership. And I'll bring everyone back. That's the cornerstone of the system. I really feel very strongly about that.
I think that's becoming more and more evident in other areas of government also.
Ma'am Chair, this is going to be a recurrent theme all next session. And Lindsay, I'm really glad you brought it up. These counties out there that may or may not lose their timber payments are constantly on the verge of bankruptcy. And you know what? It is just criminal that that's what we have going on in the state. I'm not blaming you, sir. I want to fund this as much as anything, and I want to help those folks be able to respond to their emergencies. It's criminal that this state is not taking advantage of the natural resources we've been blessed with. This state's dripping with money. Is money all around us, burning and rotting in the forest and flowing out the ocean, not being used, industrial land not being allowed to build, being built on because some political line drawn in the sand, or somebody who lives up in a concrete jungle doesn't know anything about rural Oregon. That's what's going on here. We got plenty of money in the state, Madam Chair. We just aren't going out and getting it, taking advantage of it. So every time that's brought up in this, in next session, when people whine about no money, you know what? They're not going to get any sympathy from me, because we have the money. We're just not going to get it. Thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair.
I've never heard that from him before.
Are there any more questions for Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Lindsay, so if you take, you've got the $405 million now to worry about. So if you're phasing that in, are you going to ask for anything beyond what you've asked the e-board for in the next session? I mean, since there isn't any money, I'm just curious if we should start collecting Coke cans.
Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, yes, we will be asking for additional funds for Phase 2.
How much is that?
We haven't got that calculated specifically yet.
And when does it have to be up?
When does it have to be up?
Mm-hmm. When do those monies have to be in for our system to be as operable as they should be for Phase 2? Phase 1...
Phase 1 is the build-out of microwave,
$76
million, and we hope to have Phase 1 completed by October of 2009.
Okay.
Which...
Phase 1, October 9.
Right, and I want to make sure everyone understands, that's pushing it now. Since we weren't approved in June, e-board, we lost a construction season, and we are...
Hurting.
A little bit under the gun right now.
Okay, so
I think we might be able to do it, but we'll...
Okay, and Phase 2, what's the plan for that?
Phase 2 would start right on the heels of that.
To be completed when?
That would be in the next 2 years.
So by 11.
Right.
And then the last phase by 13.
Right.
Time to go back and start, bringing back current, whatever technologies come out.
Yes.
I just recall, I just mentioned that if my memory is good, that Brian Boquist, Senator Boquist, who will be taking Senator George's place, I'm trying to get all that correct, was the biggest opponent of this. Do you recall?
Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, I don't recall.
Do you recall?
I don't recall. Okay. I remember having a meeting about where we would start in the state, and I think the Coasties got their side first. I think I remember that part, if we had to build it out over a period of three biennium, and I think that's I'm seeing a bigger area earlier than I thought I would at this
point. It started with the Northwest 7,
mm-hmm.
and it's grown to the western half of Oregon. And that's just because of the partnerships taking advantage of leveraging money. It just grew.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I've had people in the eastern half wanting to be included.
Sure.
And I've told them our scope is where it is. I can't go outside what the legislature wants me to do. But there are people in eastern Oregon that would like to partner today.
Well, that was my question, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say, at the end of Phase 2, will every county be involved?
No. Phase 2 will most likely look like the northern half of eastern Oregon, and then 3 will include the southern half of eastern Oregon. That's getting too big too fast. I can't do it all at once. We just have to phase this in. In addition to that, I think phasing is wise, because as we enter into a long-term project like this, it may come up the state has other priorities and we turn this off. I would hope that doesn't happen, but let's be realistic about it. And so if we work this in phases, we can move forward in a methodical way.
Okay, Rep. Schaffler, you get the last word. Last question.
Yeah, we've been beating this to death. And there's a lot going on here, and I appreciate your patience with us, Lindsay.
Safety.
You know, you talk about the moving target for expenses. Our budget is a moving target, too. You look at the map, clearly there's, even though it's sparsely populated, there's a lot of good folks that live out here, and we would be wrong not to get it all connected, and that would lead to probably more connections with our neighbors as well. So eventually, someday, I'd like to see the whole loop going around the entire state. You know, I think that I'm sure that's probably the direction you want to go in anyway. But it's all about money. So,
yeah, Chair Boone, Representative Schaffer, that is correct. In talking about other states, there's two other firsts that I want to mention to you, so you can understand what the planning that's taking place. IWIN is a federal program, and IWIN stands for Integrated Wireless Network. And I was familiar with a little bit of what has taken place with U.S. Department of Justice and Homeland Security. During the Winter Games in Salt Lake, they built a part of a system that linked Salt Lake and Boise together. And they did that for security issues around the Winter Games. Now, they're looking at the same thing, doing the same thing for Canada when they have the games there, which they built out in Washington. They put money in the state of Oregon. That's how we got the I-5 corridor as a result of the Olympic tryouts this summer in Eugene. They needed a communication system so that the federal government could converse and communicate. And so we took advantage of that.
Cool.
Now, but the problem I see with that, Congress has asked for a nationwide build-out of a radio communication system. They asked for that shortly after 2001. And the federal government has looked at this several ways of building it out, and the cost is tremendous. If you think of what we're spending, and if you look at that building a separate system throughout the nation, the cost is like, wow. And so recognizing that we've allowed them to ride our bandwidth on our microwave, what I've suggested to the five states, and the five states consist of Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, and Utah. And if you look at that configuration of states, Oregon is the pivot. It's in the center. And for $22.8 million of federal investment, if they help us build our microwave system backbone, I can let them ride some of our bandwidth, and we can connect the states of Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, and Utah.
So we're going to need them in an emergency.
Yeah. Now, here's the other part to that. No one's done that anywhere in the United States. It's a one-of-a-kind, well, again, it's a one-of-a-kind concept. Now, I've given you several firsts that we've come forth with this morning. And I've been back to D.C. and met with Department of Justice, and the U.S. Department of Justice representatives came out here and met with the five states as well in Portland a couple of months ago. Everyone's very enthused about the concept. They see the advantages to it.
Absolutely.
We have not, at this point, received any funding, but everyone is very, very interested in pursuing it. And they also are very amazed that the states would be willing to partner as we have and come forth with such an offer to the federal government. Now, the advantages of what that would do for us, it would give the federal government a tool and a means to communicate from Washington to Salt Lake, state of Washington to Salt Lake, through Oregon to California, anywhere in California. Now, we've taken it to the point where we've identified locations where we would interconnect with our states, our neighboring states. We can include that in the plan. And we've titled this the Western States IWIN Concept. And, in fact, next week on October 9th, we're going to have a multi-state meeting with the five Western states to talk about how we can continue this concept.
Great. That's what I...
Now, the one thing that I'm very interested in, if we do this, of course, I kind of look out for Oregon's interest, of course. One is I want to reduce the cost to Oregon. We pick up $22.8 million. That's not a bad chunk of change to have handed to you. But in addition to it, what I think is going to be extremely important is that if we can connect our emergency management systems, in other words, if we can give our Office of Emergency Management a direct connection through this type of a link to Washington, California, and Idaho, I think that will prove very advantageous to us in the face of a disaster. Because we're going to have a lot of help real fast. For instance, if there is a severe earthquake in the city of Portland, which that day will come, we're going to have aid, and I don't think I don't think you'll see the rapid response we need from FEMA just because of the distance and everything that involves that. But we can certainly call upon our neighbors.
Well, that's what I thought earlier.
And with a commercial the problem that I think we're plagued with in the face of a disaster, most commercial systems fail. But the systems that we're talking about putting in have failed, but they don't fail as often, certainly. In fact, it's the only thing that stood up to the Katrina storm and to the hurricanes in Florida. So I think that would be a real advantage for the people of Oregon if we can provide that kind of a link.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Lindsay. I'd like to hear more about that after that meeting.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. Maybe Mr. Krikova can take back to his boss a redirection of that bailout money. That would be a good use of it, and we'd get something for it. Just an editorial comment.
Well, we've been in discussion with Richard Krikova from Senator Smith's office. Senator Smith is desiring to get the congressional delegation of the five states together to help push this as well.
Good.
There's one other item very quickly, Representative Boone, that we're also looking at. It's called an intra-subsurface interface system. This is a little bit of a leading technology effort.
Can you repeat that, please?
It's an intra-subsurface interface. It's called the ISSI. Now, if you want to talk about how it works technically, I can't tell you, but I can tell you what it does do for us. It's a system that we would put in our network that would allow people to communicate and be placed on talk groups, and it wouldn't make any difference what frequency you have or what radio manufacturer you have. You would all be able to talk together. And in fact, in many instances, if your cell phone would work, we could put you in the talk group too.
Phone. You're talking about
yes.
Phones.
And what that allows us to do, typically radio, radios is a proprietary game. And if you buy one brand of radio, it doesn't simply work across the board with other brands of radios. They all have separate and distinct systems. But under the P25 project, the ISSI basically allows that interface to work so that if I have this brand A and brand B radio, I can still talk. If I have a VHF and a 700, I can still talk. And the technology is there to allow us to pursue that. And we will place an ISSI requirement in our radio RFP. And the reason I think it's so advantageous to us is I've not wanted to dictate to local government what type of radio system they have. Let's share infrastructure. And with the ISSI, I can talk to people without having to force them to buy or invest in new radios. And I always kind of think back, here we have a two-truck volunteer fire department. They don't have a lot of money to start with, but they're serving Oregon. And a lot of Oregon is rural. And if we can afford an opportunity for those type of folks in that kind of a situation to communicate with us who has a robust system, I think that's serving Oregon as well.
I think that's what a lot of people hope Owen will conclude, too. So, well, we've gone way over time. I'm sorry about that.
It's
been very important, very interesting.
Very important.
And we probably should have just given you more time to start with. But as ever, thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for bringing us the updated information. and we will see you at our next meeting.
Anytime.
Okay.
I'm available.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you.
So at this time, I'll call up Oregon Emergency Management Director Ken Murphy. And Paul, are you coming? Paul Evans with the Governor's Office. They're going to report on the status of the statewide emergency preparedness plans. And welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you. As always, Chair Boone, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, which is a division of the Oregon Military Department. The handout I gave you is a little bit more detailed explanation, and I'll just make some verbal comments. This will not take too long, but I think a couple key points. When we look at the emergency plan for the state of Oregon, as you see on the first page, it's really broken down into three different parts. You have a preparedness and mitigation portion, and I will highlight for those that have experienced a disaster, you do have to have a current mitigation plan to get extra money. So things like that are just as important as any other part of the plan. And then you actually have the Volume 2, which is the emergency operations plan, and then finally Volume 3, which is relief and recovery. We've been through a great deal since top off and the December storms on the Oregon coast, and many changes in Homeland Security, and so we've started on a project of taking a look at all three volumes of our plan. I'll take really the easiest part. The mitigation plan, we've had an approved mitigation plan from FEMA. It's called Enhanced, which allows us to get 20% of the disaster dollars for mitigation, and we're just now in the process. We have to have that updated by next year, making sure that the mitigation projects that we have for the state of Oregon are valid. The rest of it, we're trying to focus, taking the lessons that we've learned from top off, the December storms, many other events. We, of course, look at things like Hurricane Ike and Gustav and different things that have hit America, the Midwest floods, you know, that we can always take little pearls of wisdom that might work and help us. And on the second page or on the back of your paper, we're specifically making updates to those hazard-specific annexes that we look at that are generally the ones, you know, that we have to deal with or be prepared to deal with on a basis here annually. I will mention that probably one of the most significant changes that we're working on, and this is really done by the Department of Human Services and the State Public Health, is the pandemic flu plan. It's complicated, it's large, it has lots of moving parts, and it really does affect every single citizen, public, private entities in the state of Oregon. And I will tell you, the public health people and the Department of Human Services should be commended. I mean, we've been, I think we're on our third year now of taking this plan and updating it, doing exercises, tabletops. We just had a tabletop exercise last week with the utility sector on telephones and natural gas and even cable television, and how would we take care of business in a pandemic event. And so those plans are all being updated, you know, to reflect new technologies, new lessons learned that are common to any type of disaster. And then finally, some specific updates that we really are trying to flush out and taking lessons learned from not only Oregon but across the country are those bottom ones, the debris management plan. That very simply is who's going to pick up the mess and put it somewhere. Even in the North Coast floods, just many, many tons of debris, environmental issues, where do you put it, what's safe, how is it separated out, how can it be reused, And literally, you know, where do you get all the tools, the trucks, the people to do those type of things? And we're trying to take the backdrop, you know, if we do have that big earthquake or that tsunami, you know, what would you do with hundreds of metric tons of debris as they're dealing with on the Gulf Coast of Texas and what they dealt with Katrina? Drinking water and food safety. We've had lots of little issues in those areas, even with the Vernonia and the North Coast storms with drinking water systems and food safety. So there's updates that we're doing there. The mass fatalities primarily has been updated because of pan flu. Right now, the Department of Human Services Public Health Division and the State Medical Examiner's Office, we're going down around doing regional tabletop exercises around the state, you know, to try and introduce the new concepts and especially what to do if we have mass fatalities from specifically something to do with pan flu. Points of distribution, that's a fancy word for having a place on the ground where you're going to hand out food, water, and supplies. And we're trying to have a well-organized, well-set-up system across the state where we would put these points, how the points are designed so that you can easily drive in and out and be able to pick up basic supplies after a disaster or during one.
Before you leave that point, are you working with the Red Cross on that? Because I just had a meeting with them, and that sounds similar to what they're hoping to do.
Right. Yeah, Chair Boone, yes, we are. They've actually made a proposal to have storage supplies or points of distribution in physical buildings and in mobile trailers, primarily on the western side of Oregon, and primarily limited by funding. But we are working with them. Corps of Engineers is a key partner with us on that, as are many other organizations. And part of this, too, is we're, again, using that backdrop that the places you think are available probably won't be. So we're trying to look at as many alternative type of sites, you know, that may not be affected by a tsunami, an earthquake, flooding, trying to look at historical data that would show us pieces of the earth that we can use in Oregon that have a better chance of surviving. Recovery. I think most of you are aware of the recovery issues that we went through in the December storms. Mr. Evans is going to talk a little bit about that, but the whole recovery issue, if we have this meeting 2 years from now, I'll probably still be working on it because it's complicated. How do you rebuild society? How do you rebuild a community in Oregon? But we're working very hard across all jurisdictions, nonprofits, public and private agencies, trying to put together the structures that are necessary, you know, to as effectively and quickly once the response phase is done, literally starting the recovery phase during the response phase, because I think, as mentioned earlier, our economy is, you know, not well. It's fragile on any given day, and so the quicker these type of plans can be put in place, the better off we will be. And in that letter that I provided you, there's an email site where all these plans are located. They're in draft right now. And I will tell you that a lot of these, at the state level, the plans are more of a coordinating type plan. The operational type plans are found at the state agency level and the city and county. So like in the case of pan flu, you know, the Department of Human Services, Public Health, they will have the more operational 3-inch binder plan, you know, that goes into great detail if you want to look at some of the details that they deal with. So pending any of your questions, that's all I have. And I do, as noted in the letter, we're trying to have these all wrapped up and available by January of 2009. And then I will tell you that no plan is ever done. It's always a work in progress.
Well, and I appreciate that. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask you to come and give this update was in case you needed any this committee's assistance in legislation or anything coming up to help make sure these plans are as up to date as possible.
Matt, I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, Rep. Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. I didn't drive out to Vernonia. I figured they had enough
traffic out there without rubbernecking. But I did drive through Iowa this summer. I went home to my 30th high school reunion, and I grew up in Webster City, Iowa, which is in north central Iowa. I went to college in Iowa City, and I drove through. Obviously, I spent quite a bit of time in Webster City. I drove down to Iowa City to visit a friend that I grew. He was my best man. I was his. We've known each other since we were boys, and I had an opportunity to drive through town where I several buildings where I went to school were just. It was incredible how high that river. I drove through Cedar Rapids, and this was days after it all. The rivers were all receded, but they were still just all. They were taking stuff and just throwing it out to the curbside. It was just piling up, and it was like they said it was a 500-year flood. I'd seen floods there as a kid and in college, but I couldn't believe how far this, how much water there was. It just had to be incredible sight. When there is the what is your plan? I mean, these are. Metropolitan area, downtown Cedar Rapids was flooded. When you have this devastation, you don't know what's in these buildings, yet you have to go in and clean them out. How do you prepare for that? And you just have to send units in to go in and see what's in there. How do you know what you could come across some stuff that one didn't belong there, two is incredibly bad for people. How do you prepare for that? What's the plan there? I guess what my question is.
Chair Boone, Reverend Schopler, that's one of the things with the debris management plan, too. And then when you're in the response phase, and it could be any group of people, and I'll just use some examples. You have hazmat teams, or you have such as National Guard teams, or other groups, safety people. We've used from different organizations, even from Oregon OSHA, to go in and take a look if it's not inside the building or outside, to start trying to identify what is it that you're actually dealing with. Because you really don't, as much as we'd like to think we know what's in some facilities, we really don't know everything. And you have many different resources, like the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Community Right to Know program that will list out different types of chemicals and things that are in facilities. But you're really in a disaster. Those containers could be broken, or something could have floated into a building from another building that you weren't aware of, and one of the first things you need to do in any type of thing is to have some safety people, however you qualify that, to come in there to be able to start taking a look at that. And I know, I will tell you, just even from this last year's December floods and when we had the floods in 2006, it's like dairies. You never know exactly. One of the biggest problems we had with dairies is they have iodine for cleaning. And that's all well and good in a normal environment, but in a disaster where you have barrels of iodine floating around, it poses a huge threat to, you know, our citizens. So I think that's probably one of the most complicated things with the debris management plan is trying to identify what you've got to deal with, and then, of course, whatever that is, then, you know, your problem either is solved or it becomes exasperated because it becomes very complicated. And, you know, and people want to get back in their homes or their businesses, and you can't because you may have to cordon off an area because you have some very hazardous material or something illegal that you've got to deal with.
Yeah, good luck. And Rep. Kellen. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we need to move on to emergency recovery, but while we're still on preparedness, I will mention that we just talked about the floods of 06 and the December of 07, and it's almost October now, so, you know, I appreciate the work. I figure we'll be talking about 08 here soon. The one thing that I wanted to mention is that a number of, well, one specific court decision, I think, has laid some question around liability issues. The OHSU decision, the whatever that case is, I can't remember. Obviously, I'm not the lawyer. I don't cite all these cases.
Turned out to be three.
But as a result, the Oregon Law Commission has asked a work group to take a look at emergency preparedness liability issues, kind of cross-jurisdictional liabilities and those sorts of things. And I don't know. It's for one crazy moment when I wasn't thinking clearly, when I was asked to sit in on that work group, I foolishly said yes. And So now I'm surrounded by all these lawyers explaining why we have all these terrible problems going on, and I'm scared. And but I'm just there because I have some sense of what local governments need and what we need from that emergency responder who really doesn't care if he or she is moving across some jurisdictional line. They're going to do what needs to be done. And the search and rescue guy and I are trying to keep a sense of that as we move forward in this conversation. But I wanted to mention it while you guys were here so that if there's some things that I should be made aware of from your perspective, that I would appreciate that.
Chair Boone, Representative Callen, I will share with you, I'm in that room with you, so I'll be just as afraid
yes,
with
are.
Lawyers.
I was glad to know that Ken was just on the table from me so that I could run screaming to Ken.
And
I
just briefly,
you've got a plan to handle them lawyers, Mr. Murphy.
I bought a lot of duct tape. I will just brief too, and I think this is very interesting. We've dealt with this issue on liability for volunteers, medical people, search and whatever the medical search and rescue, volunteer firefighters going across jurisdictional lines, especially state lines, and this Oregon Law Commission project. Really originally started with the question of medical people, ex-doctor coming from this hospital or nurse or paramedic going to another jurisdiction, and what are their rights and their liabilities and the issues with licenses, and what are the different issues that they need to deal with. And so we were at the right place at the right time, literally, and we added in the whole emergency management arena with search and rescue and all of the other issues that we've got to deal with. And we had our first meeting. We're still waiting to take a look at things like Clark versus OHSU and all the other legal issues that we've got to look at. I will just tell you there's many. Even this room full of lawyers freely admitted that we've got different bits and pieces of law or rule addressing it, but it's not all in one place. And so I think we're going to try and get a handle on that. And then the goal is to hopefully have something ready at the beginning of the legislative session, hopefully in the way of a bill to try and address some of these issues.
You can see why I'm glad that Ken is there to make some sense out of whatever these people are talking about.
The calming of
and the duct tape.
Rep. Nelson, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. I would like to take this opportunity after 8 years here in the legislature to bring this up again, over and over and over and over. And for some reason, we did not realize our responsibility to safety as our top priority when it comes to a transportation network. And if we don't somehow decide, and I hope the governor will take the lead without the three green transportation committees, but one that just focuses on safety, because there's no way that we can even with the wonderful National Guard and our helicopter companies, there's no way that we can move people in the case of a tragedy. And if we don't do something about getting, we have all the network of communications that we need, but if we can't move the people from the coast inland, or we can't move Portland south because of the Newburgh-Dundee traffic jam, and that happens to end up being the same road from the coast in, everything we're doing is phony baloney. And never, ever have I seen this in any of our emergency preparedness. And like Mike spent a lot of time in Iowa, well, I spent a lot of time in New Orleans this summer, and I wanted to understand why this still happens there. And it is, besides handling the infirm, the criminals, transportation is a critical issue. But compared to theirs, ours seems so much worse. I mean, I would say, of course, since I don't live there, I'm not as aware of it. But this seems, 200 times. So I'm going to hope that, you know, I brought this up over and over and over over my, you know, tenure here, and I still work on it, have a group working on it again, but we're not doing what's right. I mean, our transportation infrastructure is so inadequate, unsafe, misplanned, that it's just so critical. And I hope that you'll add that to this plan and make it, you know, as critical as any other phase of it. It's one thing to have, you know, a plague, but if you can't transport the proper medication, doesn't matter, every one of these. And the same thing, and I had an incredible young man who I paid considerable money to have this tour in New Orleans, because I really wanted to understand it. You know, it took me to the houses and showed me the watermarks, showed me the marks that they put on every home and how they categorize, you know, which is very sickening to me. You know, showed me levees that are only as thick as my backyard fence. You know, showed me people rebuilding in the same location where they've been wiped out before. You know, maybe three or four houses being put on stilts. I mean, he had no sympathy for his people. This young man, I mean, he's going, where's the leadership here in this state to get us to, you know, put together a plan that is right? A livability plan, you know, and an emergency plan. So, Ken, you've heard me say this before, and Paul probably has. I'm sure the governor has, and I know General. No, this good general over here has.
Caldwell.
I was going to say Cassidy, you'll probably say. Caldwell. Please get on that.
And Chair Boone, Representative Nelson, we have been working, and not recently, we've been doing this for a long time with and the Oregon Department of Transportation. You know, we do have many alternative route plans. I surely can't, you know.
Just can't use them.
Well, yeah, and we're trying to look at, you know, if one road is down, two roads are down, how many different alternatives, and then working not only with private industry when it comes to helicopters and or the National Guard, you know, trying to look at, you know, what is available to us at a moment's notice, you know, on any given day to deal with these issues.
Welcome, General.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I wasn't going to come up here. I thought you were behind time, but I couldn't help myself.
Critical.
For the record, we're here, General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. I think Ken's absolutely right. We learned some things during top-off, just doing it notionally, that things don't work so well when you're trying to move a lot of people out of Portland, either direction. I think the reality is, and Ken mentioned this earlier, is that particularly for these plans that these communities need to do, and I see you've got Cannon Beach on here earlier, and I know we've had some conversations with their city manager, and I think that the reality is that the communities are going to have to fend for themselves for probably up to 72 hours or longer. And there isn't going to be an ability to move out. There isn't going to be an ability for us to fly in. Our helicopters, for instance, they're being deployed here in a few months, and we're going to have two left in the state.
Yeah.
The airstrips that are available for fixed-wing airplanes to land on are few and far between on the coast and other rural parts of Oregon. There's bridge issues, and so communities are going to have to fend for themselves for that period of time. And I think it was mentioned earlier by Lindsay that we know that in a catastrophic issue, we're going to have to rely on other people to come in and help us, whether they be the other states with the compacts that we have or FEMA, and it's going to take time to get here. So if you can't fend for yourself for at least 48 to 72 hours, then you're probably going to be in real peril. And I think that's the message, and we wholeheartedly agree that the transportation networks are overstressed and inadequate for most daily work, let alone during an emergency. So I think if there's any message that we want to send and we want to get this out to the communities, and we're working on that, for instance, Astoria didn't have a mitigation plan, okay, when the storm hit. Clatsop County didn't have a mitigation plan. They were working on it, but it wasn't in. And that costs you money at the back end for FEMA. So there's these things that need to be constantly worked on. And we also know that we're going to have tough budgets this next go around. So there's going to be less money, and counties, county commissioners and city councilmen are going to be pressed hard to do the fundamental things that they know they got to do. And planning for an emergency that may or may not come is not going to be high on the list when you got people stacked up in front of your health department trying to get a free shot for their babies.
Right.
So we recognize that, and I think that's the thing that the legislature has to, you mentioned leadership, I think it has to come from the legislature. I know the governor supports it, and we need to make sure that that message stays on, even though there are going to be some very, very difficult financial issues this next session. So we make that pitch. I know you're going to have a lot on your plate and a lot to consider, but these are important issues, and they will cause great, great harm to our citizens if they can't manage that first 72 hours.
Madam Chair, you know, the more I sit in these rooms, the more frustrated I get. You know, we're mired in this quagmire overseas, and it's just sucking the life out of this country. We got an economy that's in a tank because people are making profligate wages and salaries and profits off of paper. This drives us into the gutter. We had people that refuse to accept the fact that we have the natural resources in this country and state to be totally independent. You know, everywhere you look on the spectrum, there's a finger to point to blame. And here we are sitting here talking about this. But there's hope. Because next year, transportation is going to be one of the top priorities here. And we're going to have an opportunity to do something about it here in this state among ourselves. Regardless of the left or the right, how bad they're screwing it up in federal government, we have an opportunity here to do something about it in this state. And I hope that we do accomplish some positive and good. And I think at the state level, in those other areas, we can do some things too. So thank you, Representative, for sharing your concern about that.
Rep. Callen.
Since we're all venting today and venting today, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. I
need to get back on one of my soapboxes. We need to do this planning and preparation from a governmental level. That's critically important, and that's the reason that many of us are so committed to the kinds of committees that we sit on. And I know that there are needs, and I know there are ways we can try to meet them, but what General Caldwell just said is too important to not reinforce it, and that's that in that first 24 to 72 hours, communities and individual citizens need to take the personal responsibility to take care of themselves. And I think it's imperative that those of us who work in the governmental arena and we try to reassure people that we're going to be there to help and we're going to do everything, need to also take that personal responsibility to reiterate that message when we have the soapboxes at home to talk about. We need to, within our own families, make personal plans for how we're going to care with the members of our families that might need additional assistance, or find your children if you're going to be separated during the day, and not expect, it's not humanly possible for government to be on your front step in the first 20 minutes offering you anything that you might need. We need to be able to take care of ourselves and have some of those emergency preparations taken care of. So thank you for bringing that up again. I think we get waylaid from personal responsibility when we're talking about what government needs to do.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, we do, and I think and I'll just give you an example. Right after the scares of the anthrax scares in Washington, D.C., and then there was the sniper, if you recall all those incidents, that I happened to be in D.C. for some meetings, and it was my taxicab driver had a thing that the D.C. government had put out that was incredibly informative. I mean, I thought, whoa, this is great stuff. You know, it talks about how to get in and out of town, what happened, you know, really informative, and that personal planning on what to do. You know, how do you react and make sure every house or every household and every family has that plan? Came back, grabbed Ken, and I said, gee, we need to get this done. He said, well, we've got all this stuff on the web, but, you know, we don't have the people, number one. We didn't have a public affairs person in his shop. And they've been here to this into the legislature three or four times asking for it and got denied. We didn't have the money to produce the stuff to get out like D.C. did, and I'm sure they got a federal, you know, all federal money just came down, flowing down, and it was really good information. But it's a constant battle, and every community has to continue to do that. And we have Emergency Preparedness Week. We have all these things, and now he's got one PA person that we can start doing some things and working with communities. But we're basically working on the tin cup and out on the street saying, putting nickels in here to pay for it. And communities aren't taking, they don't have that kind of money. Now, I don't know what the answer is, and I don't think you can solve it with one mailer. I don't think you can solve it with two mailers. I think it's a constant drumbeat of elected officials, government leaders, and other concerned citizens making sure that people know these sort of things and do that personalized planning, because that's all that's going to be left. You're absolutely right. There isn't enough government out there to get to these people in 20 minutes or probably in 48 hours. And so they've got to do that sort of thing. And I don't know how you go about that, but I can assure you we're the mindset with timber payments, down economy, all the issues that we're facing here in Oregon, then more than likely the locals are going to look at emergency management pretty dimly this next go around as budgets start coming together. And I think I've seen it before. I've watched it before. It's happened. And so we're very concerned about that at our level. We're trying to figure out strategies on how to deal with that when it happens. And we know it will. We just don't know how much.
Well, that is a perfect segue into my rant.
Gotta get them all in. Bring the level of good feelings up a little bit. And just mention briefly that in Tillamook, they have an Oregon Solutions project going for flood mitigation, and just christened the first project. And basically what they're doing is increasing the ability for the drainage to spread out more so it doesn't just go up and flood. That's happening. Those projects are moving forward. That's a classic partnership program, too. And the second is that will be a perfect segue into Jay Raskin from Cannon Beach to talk about some of the local stuff going on. But up and down the coast, there are local preparedness programs going on, and that is their main message, is you have to take responsibility for yourself. So they're doing neighborhood outreach programs, et cetera, et cetera. And I just attended in Manzanita. They have tiny little Manzanita, less than 1,000 people, have 26 neighborhood captains. Wow. And these people are reaching out to people, and it's a constant thing. Seaside did theirs, and we need to get to their leadership and remind them that it is a constant effort. You can't just say, okay, that's done, it's over with, and set it aside. You have to keep doing it because people move in and out. Right. We have lots of visitors, lots of events, and Hood to Coast will bring in 80,000 people, and that's exactly what's going to happen. It'll choose a day like that, and to have something happen. So anyway, it's happening up and down the coast, local efforts, and they're fairly inexpensive efforts. And there are more and more people coming out of the woodwork and actually enterprising personalities that they are putting together packets, for people like me who, I could go and take a day and get all the stuff I need. And they're even getting it to, this is a one-person packet for your car, a one-person packet for your emergency prep. This is a 48-hour kit, 72-hour kit. Here's the two-week kit. And, things like that. And don't forget the cat food and the dog food, things like that. So people are putting these little car kits together because chances are you might not be at home where your big cache is. And the Red Cross doing their idea and having caches, Seaside has caches in town, and, reminding people constantly. And they're having people come and speak to groups, the local community groups, in the assisted living centers, et cetera. So things are happening on the local level because people, and I don't know if this is good or bad, don't think that government can help them, or they'll be so ditzel-headed they won't figure out what to do. So we tell them, no, government's working on it too, but you're absolutely right. There aren't enough of them unless you want us to increase government more, which we don't get that kind of money for, and we're getting some real creative activities going on out there, and I keep hoping, and I hope that Ken will come again, and maybe, by repeated efforts we can get these things going. The bad news is what we don't want to have to happen is a horrible event coming up. Here we come into the storm season again to remind us, because I'm here to tell you that the downed timber that made all the news, shows, that's right down the street from my house, so I couldn't get out for 2 days. But it's finally getting cleaned up now. They've got all the slash cleaned up, and that went to compost. And so a lot of compost is made out of this. That's a good thing. And that also freed up the logging efforts, to the salvage logging. They're all, these trees are down, but they were down like jackstraws and created very unstable and dangerous situations, and a lot of loggers got hurt. And so now it's to the point where they can, it's almost like a normal situation. They're pulling those logs up. They're going to replant. And so just in time for the storm season again. So there are efforts out there. It's a continuing thing, and I just wanted to, while you're three up here, I appreciate everything you do, all the help that you provide, and
absolutely.
And I am so sorry to hear that you're going to have all your equipment leave again, because two helicopters isn't quite enough, you know.
It's pretty minimal, and then we have 3,500 soldiers
deploying
in the spring, and all of our helicopters. So yeah, we're going to be stretched thin for anything at that point, and that's.
And you guys were the local heroes in my district after this last storm, along with Ken's people, and the governor was down there right away. I mean, it was unbelievable. These people really do care about us, and I so appreciate it.
And we appreciate you continuing to make that message clear to people, is that this is a constant thing. It's going to take, you know, maybe 20 years, maybe 100 years before we have one of them, but you got to be ready, and that's the issue, is keeping it on in their mind.
And I even ate those little cookie things that they had.
The MREs?
Whatever. They weren't that bad.
We had those.
Bad. They were kind of like dry, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put enough ketchup on it, it's okay.
Delicious, Debbie. Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
If you need any ketchup,
Stop. Well, you're just, I'm please, so just, patient.
May I, thank you, okay. Be patient just one more minute. I'm just curious how y'all would rate FEMA on their response here. What?
I keep putting them on the spot there.
Yes, and I want to, because I'll tell you why. How would you rate them using a Moderic 10 scoring system, 10 being the best?
I would say they were at least between 8 and 10, right in there. I think that they did some things marvelously well, and they did some things that were, you know, kind of stupid, but I think that was, you know, considering the event, and particularly what happened in Washington with I-5 being shut down, and that hit first, and we got it second, or kind of how it worked. I thought they did an excellent job, frankly.
The reason I wanted to ask that question, Tribune, is because in asking that question in Louisiana while I was there, and having worked with FEMA here, here was the reason they gave for being so much more successful here than there. Contrary to all this great media we have that's phony baloney, in my words, is that in the first storm, they didn't have volunteers down in New Orleans. We had, or you had, you people who were in the floods, and we did in Sheridan, I know, in Willamina, you had city officials and individual citizens who just said, here we are, we're not going to work, we're helping. They explained to me in Louisiana that the problem was everybody was concerned about their homes, their families, and getting them out. They didn't have bus drivers. I mean, that whole mess that we saw on TV, the truth we never heard, really. It was because they were not organized. So when you talk about this local, I thought, boy, that's it. I'm going. Our emergency manager just quit in Yamhill County. But I said, I'm going to go back and get a list. We need so many volunteers that stay on a list and a communication number per how many people. You know, what should that be? 1 to 10? Or I'm just guessing a little bus maybe could hold 10 people. So we all need to maintain that list, but they said that was number one. I mean, we can talk about all the other problems, you know, the bad levees and all this stuff, bad planning and FEMA and all this, but it really was. They didn't have enough individuals to step up to the plate. Even the firemen and policemen, I mean, they were all worried about their homes and families and getting them out. So I thought, boy, is that a list, that emergency citizen support list.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll just comment, Chair Boone, Representative Nelson. I agree with General Caldwell. And I talked to my counterparts in Louisiana behind the scenes, and what you saw on TV is what you saw, but it was not truthful.
But that's right.
You know, FEMA had some problems. There's unquestionably it did. But I will tell you that the cities, the parishes, the state of Louisiana had just as many problems.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think a lot of it's relationships, too.
Exactly.
And you got to take being prepared seriously. And, you know, and I guess, you know, I'll speak to my counterparts around the country. When you have a disaster like a hurricane, that a little bit more statistically higher probability of happening every year versus an earthquake here in Oregon, I'd want to really be very prepared and be having beer with my FEMA people in a bar, making sure we had everything lined up and squared away. And even after this last storm in December in the Gulf Coast, they have a thing called pre-disaster landfall declarations, which can bring FEMA in ahead of time. And in a hurricane, generally speaking, you have 72 hours notice thanks to the National Weather Service. Well, when we started thinking about this last one in December here, we had 72 hours notice. And it's not called a hurricane, but when you break down the true definition, we had a hurricane. And so part of these plans, or at least in the back of my mind, if I get that same phone call from the National Weather Service that we did last year, I'm going for a pre-landfall declaration, get FEMA and everybody else.
And pre-landfall?
Right, pre-landfall. That's before the storm actually hits the coast.
Pre-landfall
declaration.
Cool.
And that authorizes a certain amount of money and different things from FEMA. I would also try and do the same thing through the military department, the governor's office. You know, that, I mean, we know it's coming.
Right.
You know,
good
and even if the weather service is off just a little bit in their prediction, you're still better off and prepared.
And they can do that.
I just add to that is that we, you know, speaking of FEMA, the governor's office jumped into this thing with both feet early on, and we did not anticipate that we would get a presidential declaration for probably a week. You know, that's typical. And the governor made the request, made some phone calls, talked to some folks, him and his staff did, and we had the thing in record time. And fact is, the state of Washington hadn't gotten theirs yet, and we got ours.
All right.
And I think that was all due to the fact that the governor took, you know, not only personal interest, but he wanted to make sure that happened. I don't think FEMA would have hesitated either way, but even they were surprised about it, and it did open up some pots of money that they could get out by having that presidential deck that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So I think that helped their performance here. Mm-hmm. And there was only a couple of minor things that I would even tell you that I was disappointed in FEMA on, and they were fairly minor. Everything else, they were leaning forward fast,
great,
efficiently, and working hard at it.
Paul.
Chair, board members of the committee, I must apologize. At 11 o'clock, I have to go meet with some very frustrated people.
I know, we're extremely over. So,
hey, but that works for me. I have to leave at 11, too.
Okay, and so we have one more.
Try to cut to the chase as quick as I can on some of these things.
Please. Put the microphone in front of you, would you please?
Yes. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm the Emergency Preparedness Policy Advisor for Governor Kongoski. There's actually two things that are trends in this that are really going to be something that impacts money, but is a decision that the legislature is going to have to come together as a whole on. One is on these preventative strategies, on the idea of investing things before an event occurs. It's not terribly sexy, it's not terribly exciting, but it's very important. And in those cases, what would be helpful is clear guidance from the legislature that if expenditures are made on a reasonable basis before the fact, that we won't be punished for doing that. Offline, at another occasion, I'll explain to you some concerns I have that have happened recently in that area. I'm hoping that that's an aberration and not the trend. Today, what I would like to talk with you is really in view of recovery. This governor has a very proactive philosophy, and what part of that is, it is truly a partnership between the legislature and the governor in terms of building a structure that takes the best of what government can do, as well as flexibility at the local level. So we try to have really as much of the cake and eating it too at the same time as we can. What's in front of you currently is the Executive Order 0820 that was signed into existence in August. It's very clear, or very close to what we did in the December storm. We took the lessons that worked. We kind of changed some things that didn't work so well. But this is, today's discussion is really in follow-up to what we talked about in January, and that as we develop this recovery approach, a proactive philosophy, that as we learn a lesson, we put it into place, we come to the legislature and explain what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it. It really has four or five major components, and I'll try to run through those very quickly. The first is it actually recognizes in black letter print that the state of Oregon is a primary, bears primary responsibility for recovery. What we mean by that is there are some things FEMA just can't fund. But that doesn't mean that they're not important or that they don't need to be done. And eventually FEMA goes home to another or to another disaster. That's kind of what they do. But we live here. And the governor is very clear and has been consistent in making sure that he doesn't want process to get in the way of helping people. So the fact that Oregon says recovery is an important goal, an important duty, is really one of the main pieces. The other piece is it divides, and if you want the full-up slides, I'll send them to you electronically, but it really puts into print some definitions that we talked about in January, but it makes them a little more firm here. The emergency recovery framework, recognizing that it is flexible, it is a skeleton that can be built as needed for tailored situations. It explains what the recovery planning cell is, to emphasize what General Caldwell and Director Murphy said as far as simultaneous response and recovery planning. The idea that there is a seamless transition from response into implementation of that day after planning. It is a full mobilization of all public assets and all resources so that we never have to look the public in the eye and say, well, we wished we could have done something, but we didn't talk to that person or this person. It, again, is a very proactive approach. That means sometimes there may be some funds spent on something that's never used in the planning process, but at least we'll have it if we need it. Another thing talks about the recovery planning cell and the transition after 7 to 10 days into the governor's recovery cabinet. This is important because it recognizes in black letter print that the locals have a stake in this, structurally have a stake in this, that on the recovery cabinet there will be representatives of the local areas. It also explains, and I know that during the January experience, there was discussion about, you know, the breadth of the executive power of the governor during times of disasters. And one of the things we had talked about at that time was that there are going to be cases that are the extraordinarily hard, extraordinarily difficult circumstances. Vernonia, for example, in this last flood. And that more power than less may be needed to do things that are necessary in those targeted areas. And to make sure that the government is, in fact, a full partner, the existence of an economic recovery council that is comprised of local leaders that are directly connected to the economic recovery zones, those areas that are hardest hit, and then again that they are reflected in the governor's cabinet so that as decisions are made from the executive level, all pieces of information from different points of view are at least put on the table. May not necessarily, the locals may not get everything they want, but it is critical that the local governments and the local private sectors and the citizens at large have a stake in how we put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's really the purpose. The other thing is that it defines really commander's intent in terms of how the governor views the executive power during times of emergency and gives a little bit of explanation in terms of what kinds of cases would require an economic recovery zone designation. And then finally, two things that we put under measurements and expectations. The first is that every 6 months there'll be a report from the governor's recovery cabinet to the public at large. We did a conference this past June. It was essential, I think, to make sure that there's full transparency. The counties were engaged in that. The agencies were engaged in that. It did two things. Number one, it made sure that the press understood exactly what had happened, what steps had been taken. And number two, it was an opportunity for us to take a pulse check and see what we did well, what we didn't do well, what we need to work on, and so we can focus on the next 6 months. Understanding that in this particular case, at 6 months' time, there were really only two projects outstanding, and FEMA was taking the lead on those two projects. But the next time around, it may be a longer period of time. And what this executive order wanted to do was to guarantee the legislature that at all steps in the process, it's open, it's transparent, and that communication is going to be flowing back and forth as much as possible. The recovery program, the standard operating procedures for the economic recovery framework, we have in draft. We're hoping to put those out in January for agency leaders to look at. We'll send them clearly to this committee or whatever committee handles this issue in the legislature. One of the things that I think has been critical to the success of this is really your support as legislators and your willingness to engage and be involved in the discussions. And again, from the governor's perspective, one of the reasons for the executive order was to make sure that the legislature knew where we were headed and is that active partner so that we never find ourselves in a situation with people saying, well, look, governor's office didn't tell us this or we don't have that communication bridge. We want to make sure that that is there. Now, the other issue that really is concerning when you look at recovery, when you look at one end of the spectrum, you have to look at the other, is that we are going into a time of significant financial stress. Everybody recognizes the challenges to the general fund going into the next year. I don't know how that will shape, especially with more economic studies coming out. However, there are some investments, especially in lieu of the timber payments issue, there are some investments that would be critical if other non-general fund kind of opportunities could present themselves. There's a number of working groups that are trying to find ways that can help across the spectrum. The bottom line is, the one reality of the federal government currently being the situation we're in, with potentially a debt ceiling of $11.1 trillion, is that our emergencies are going to have to be more expensive for them to come in the future. That's obvious. That's already in the process. And the second thing is, as General Cobo said, not only are communities going to have to learn how to do things on their own, but the state, to some degree, is going to have to be more creative, because the flexibility of the federal government just is not going to be there. And in the next, one of the reasons that this recovery framework was put in place the way it is to make sure that those communications between all branches of government, at the public, all levels of government, is that we recognize as we go into next year with 3,500 of our folks deployed, much of our equipment deployed, the National Guard forever transitioned into an operational force, and the federal government constrained, we have to cooperate and collaborate at a level we really haven't done before. And at that point, I'll just close my babbling and thank you for the opportunity to present that.
Any questions for Rep.
Chuck? I know Paul has to go, but and you know, I'm not going to go into the timber thing. I think I beat that to death. We know how to take care of ourselves. We just need to go out and do it. And the federal government needs to help us do that too. Paul, I'm there. The governor's doing a lot in here, and believe me, I understand someone has to be in charge and take leadership and make decisive action and decisions on the spot. I think, though, you could. I'm kind of. Is there a constitutional question here about some of the things the governor would be doing relative to
Chair
executive
Boone
versus legislative, judicial?
Chair Boone, Representative Schaffer. Actually, I'm glad you asked that question. This executive order actually goes the other direction. Instead of the broad authority of ORS 401, which the Attorney General has said, yeah, that's pretty big, what we've tried to do is actually put out the philosophy in form and structure to actually harden it up a little bit so that there's more certainty on the part of the legislature, so you kind of know kind of how he plans on executing certain aspects. The actual powers of a governor during times of emergency are extraordinarily broad, and necessarily so for disasters. One of the marching orders I've received from the governor and senior staff is to make sure that the legislature knows the direction we're going into, and at every level of the process understands equal partner, that the processes are very flexible and very transparent, so that we actually ease some concerns in terms of too much use of the broad authority of the governor. And as far as constitutional questions, there are none. This was cleared by both legal counsel and AG's office. And again, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to give me a call. We're going to be trying to roll this out to a number of conferences as well, so local governments understand. Really, this is actually pretty rare in terms of a state saying you're an equal partner in this kind of approach, and we're hoping to strengthen those relationships.
We appreciate that.
Thank you. Yeah. And just quickly,
yes,
I think
ma'am.
That's an important piece that you take to local government.
Yes, ma'am.
There's always that fear that somebody's telling us what to do.
As a former mayor, I'm very, very cautious on that whole thing.
I think
thing.
You did a good job of keeping the local governments on the recovery teams as mm-hmm. we moved through the last one, but it's something we can continually reinforce.
Yes, ma'am. And again, I apologize for having to leave, but thank you very much.
Oh,
for
thank
your
you. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Thanks all three of you. And I call up Cannon Beach Mayor Jay Raskin with deep and humble apologies for going so far over. But as you can see, so much information, and it's so important to hear.
May I offer Mayor an apology?
Please, go ahead. Rep. Cowan wants to say something.
Mayor Raskin, I really want to apologize for getting up and leaving. I do have a time commitment.
I understand.
I will read the document. Good, I got it.
And
I was
going to
say,
I'll
get
call,
an update.
Yeah. I'll call her.
Okay.
And
you.
Welcome, Jace. Thank you so much for coming all the way and agreeing to do this today. It's very important.
Chair Boone and the other committee members, I'm very happy to come up. Just to give you
a little background about this is Cannon Beach just, Ogami for Cannon Beach just completed a new tsunami evacuation, tsunami inundation mapping effort, which is quite extraordinary because it basically got the latest computer technology, tsunami computer modeling, on-site data that was done with some studies in Cannon Beach up the watershed, and then also included data from Sumatra event and offshore landslides studies. What we were hoping, actually Cannon Beach helped fund this in the beginning with $10,000 each from City of Cannon Beach, the Cannon Beach Rural Fire District, and the Seaside School District. And we were actually hoping that we were going to beat back an idea that there were really big Cascadia events and tsunamis out there, and unfortunately the study proved the contrary. Mm-hmm. And there are bigger Cascadia events and tsunamis than we thought, and as we are, the practical reality for us when we finally looked at this is that these larger events with the larger tsunamis basically mean that there's not high ground adjacent for people to evacuate to, particularly in our downtown area. We had thought that basically with good education and outreach that everyone could reach high ground, and now we know that's not going to work. So the question became, what do we do now? And we were at the same time looking at our city hall, which is a perfectly adequate building, except for the fact that in an earthquake it'll fall down and that any tsunami coming through will wipe out the rest of it. We had been looking about let's relocate this, and we're a small community and bounded by state and private forest lands, and we really didn't have another site for it. What turned out to be a good thing was that if in these larger events that people are evacuating from our downtown, the way they're going to be heading is right past our city hall, and so we said maybe we could build a building that would shelter them there. It turns out that in Japan they've done several of these buildings. There's nothing been done in the United States. And then we also found out that FEMA had been studying guidelines for actually studying to do a publication to give guidelines for such a building, and that just came out this year. So working with Yume Wang from Dogami and actually some other people such as Professor Harry Yeh at Oregon State, who's a tsunami expert and a tsunami evacuation expert, a fellow named Kent Yu from Dagan Kobe, and another engineer named Javier Moncado who works in a firm that studies oil platforms and stuff like that. We basically have determined that this is a feasible thing to do. We also went up to FEMA and said, if we would come up with such a project using these guidelines, would you help fund this? And they said that they have a program called the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund Grant Program, and that we would be eligible for that. But in reviewing what's necessary, it's quite competitive grant process. They want a benefit cost analysis, and that's in order to get something that's basically competitive, that's basically a quite expensive feasibility study. We also realized in talking with Dogami is that we're not the only ones who'll be in this situation. Even before this, when we knew places like Seaside and was already in a terrible situation with not being with high ground and needing such a structure. But you know, even in Clatsop County, I can come with about 8 locations where these sorts of structures might be necessary, and I'm sure the need down the coast is equally great. So we have a project. We have and the city council is basically thinks that we need to proceed on this, and we're asking the legislature to help us with feasibility study money, basically to leverage the money from FEMA. This is also a priority that was given that was reviewed by the Oregon State Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee, and I've attached their letter to Governor Kulongowski. And the other, I've also attached on the back of it basically a very conceptual design about what it might look like. And the elements are basically we'd be raising the building up about 15, 16 feet above the existing grade. Essentially all the governmental offices would be on that second level. and we would have a rooftop terrace, and we hope to have provide at least space for emergency, for at least 1,000 people to basically get out of the way of the tsunami. We've also contacted the Japanese consulate in Portland, because we wanted to learn more about the experiences in Japan, and they very graciously have agreed to help us contact the individuals and communities and design professionals in Japan so we can try to glean some of their experience for our project.
And I thank you, Jay, and I must say, tell people how lucky I am to have Jay in my district.
I think
the
so.
The city of Cannon Beach, unfortunately, we lost our mayor, John Williams, a couple of months ago, and Jay has stepped in. But Jay has been very, you're an architect by,
yes,
by trade, and he is very, very involved locally and not so locally on this issue. He is kind of the local go-to guy. There's a group of them. There's a geologist in the area. We have several people spread out in Clatsop County and into Tillamook County who provide expert their experience and their expert testimony. And I hope that we can. It looks like you're asking for $100,000 for that. And
that was the recommendation from OSPAC, and it turned out to be fairly accurate as we've gone down bit by bit. The study would include basically from Professor Ye an evacuation study, basically, mm-hmm. so we can actually prove we would say this is the evacuation, how many people fatalities we might have in the tsunami, and then if we did this building, what, you know, how many people can we actually save by doing some computer
modeling.
He did
that with the tower, and if you had these in Japan, they have towers that are vertical towers that people can get into, and his computer modeling shows, you know, in the numbers when the wave comes in. But when I wanted to, and I got you down, I wanted to ask you, would this feasibility study be applicable to other communities so that it would, you know, say five different communities, when he said he could think of eight locations for a similar structure in Clatsop County, could they all go in on a feasibility study, and would the results be applicable with minor tweaks for individual needs?
Chair Boone, in the whole process, in a global sense, yes, mm-hmm. but every project is going to be a different size, different
right.
different configuration, different needs. So what's hard now is that what we're faced with is that no one's ever done one of these before.
Yeah.
There's no person, group, or anything we can go to say, well, what's one going to cost, and mm-hmm. what problems really are there? We're in the just for example on codes, we're very good on our building codes to get people out of a building quickly, but we assume that people get in, on a leisurely fashion, and this is a building that basically needs to operate that way, but also we need to get people into the building really quickly. What does that really mean? No one's ever thought it through. What does this mean in terms of ADA accessibility? Mm-hmm. We don't know. So there's lots of issues. Those sorts of kind of really, those sorts of questions, this project will be applicable for everybody. But in the specific building and some things, it's
very
not going to be a building that somebody could then take to a different location and say, we'll do this building.
Yeah. Rip Shockley.
Thank you. Yeah, my cousins have a little cabin on a beach in Rockaway, and it has a wood foundation. It's built decades ago, and it would literally float away unless it was crushed by the water first. So if I lived down there, I would certainly want something like this. My question is, and I don't know, maybe the piece, and I was going to ask that very question, could we use this up and down the coast? And I suppose there's some procedural things that would lock into every community, but you know, the topography, the elevations, the population, the streets, everything goes into. How do you determine, and maybe the study would determine this, what elevation to put this at? I mean, the Pacific Ocean is a huge body of water. How do you know where the water is going to crest or not? I mean, how do you know?
Well, Chair Boone and Representative Schaffler, actually the thing that you did at the beginning of the this work session is a critical part of it. In actual fact, because of the study that Togami did and how detailed it was, we actually know what the depth of the water will be at the city halls anywhere in Cannon Beach.
Sure.
So we know that on one event, the water is going to be about 6 feet deep at city hall. At another event, it might be at 15 feet. So we've just basically picked the one that seems the most reasonable, but that data essentially is available to us, and it's because of this study that we could actually go forward. It's also a reason why we would actually stand a chance to go to FEMA for the PDM grants, because we actually have detailed information to base this on.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Rep. Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Raskin, weren't you here at one of our meetings earlier, last session?
Yes, wait. I was.
And were you here when I thought it was the individuals from Seaside came and they had the scientists with them that have determined we haven't got 30 years, much less 50? I mean, we have that in our data. Weren't you here?
Yes, Chair Boone and Representative Nelson. We basically have been advised by Dogami and that there's a 1 in 6 chance in the next 50 years. Of course, when they said that was 8 years ago. So
it's 30.
Well, so this is what they. The other thing that that's more recent is that they're telling us now scientific studies on the southern part of this big fault line that's offshore, there's a recurrence interval of about 233 years. So it's been 308 years since the last one. So at this point, I think we're definitely living on borrowed time.
Oh, I felt that we had so much data. I was so impressed when y'all were here before, and the scientific data, I mean, I've told the world that, and that's why this is so critical to me. And I could, you know, I came from an aviation career where safety is the top priority, and it makes me mad when I know that should be the top priority in all government agencies and entities, regardless what area, and then we don't make it the top priority. We find all these other things to do. So thank you for what you're doing. And I just want us to, you know, when you come to the legislature, have a sense of urgency, because the majority of those, you know, kids like Mike and Debbie who are there will be in 30 years as old as us old people, and they'll be grateful for your help. I come from a part of the country where we go underground because of tornadoes. So. Are you saying this has to be above ground? I mean, have we studied that? Have we seriously studied that to know whether y'all could come underground like we do in the Panhandle of Texas and put our city halls and things underground?
Chair Boone and Representative Nelson, no, we need to go up because
you have to go up.
We have to go up. This wave is going to come in, and we want the water to go wash underneath us.
So, I see. So there's not enough rock, like you know, in Carlsbad, New Mexico, where you know we go down. I forget how many miles, and that's where they're storing all our radioactivity for the nation. And I'm just thinking, isn't it strange that they're going underground and we're going above ground?
Geography matters.
Yes, that is.
So there's nothing, yes. There is no wall of rock or whatever it is to protect us anywhere on the coast that would withstand a tsunami.
There are, the real problem is that there are places, I mean, even just north of Cannon Beach, there's Cold Estate Park, which is quite high, and it's a nice piece of basalt, but the people are down near the beach. And that's where we live and where we play are mostly down near where the water's going to come in.
Okay, but I just want to understand this. Back to New Orleans again. We don't have levees, but do we not have any solid rock structures to be barriers that would withstand tsunami?
No.
No.
I see Dogami Queen back there shaking her head no. So
well, good.
I'll hear from her.
To know.
Yeah.
Because the rest of us that don't live there, you know, we see those mountains and you think.
Drill a tunnel,
yeah.
I suppose, but might fill it. Well, Mayor, Your Honor, thank you so much.
Thank
for
you
coming.
For all you do. I admire you.
And we'll actually talk later, too, again, and see if we can. Don't leave yet. Yeah,
okay.
Don't leave yet. See what we can do, because it seems like if we could even make the case for just a basic feasibility study to be, you know, applied with individual data that could help defray a cost like that. It might help. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Dr. McConnell.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Boone and committee members. For the record, Vicki McConnell, the Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I just wanted to just quickly say a couple of things. Mayor Raskin is really giving you a great summary of both the work that we've done out there, and now they want to take that information and actually use it in planning so that they can be more responsive to the hazards that are out there. So what I have handed out is just, again, it's somewhat mirroring, both applauding Cannon Beach for being so proactive and working with us to develop a tsunami inundation model for the North Coast. This has been a very positive thing, although Mayor Raskin doesn't think so, because we did come in with some waves that are a little higher than they expected. But it's better to know than not know what's going to occur, and then you know what you're planning for. We had just a great program and a great mapping program to get this completed, and I'm just so appreciative for it was both Cannon Beach and the school district and the emergency group all went together and funded that. So I won't belabor that point. As I said, the next thing is, how do you plan to then respond and recover? And the idea of vertical evacuation has been really, it's an idea that's from Japan, where they have to really worry about this all the time. Guidelines for design of structures for vertical evacuations has come out by FEMA. The second page of this is just a little, again, some ideas on what this building, a tsunami evacuation building, would have to, what you would need to have in that, kind of global idea of what we need to have in it. We certainly hope that Cannon Beach can move forward with this. It would be it would be their city hall, but it would be a prototype that could then be used up and down the coast for other areas. Seaside is another area that really has an issue about this, because they really have nowhere to go. So it's a great idea. If we can get the feasibility study and then be able to apply for the pre-disaster mitigation funding, would be a great way to go with this. One thing I did want to explain, Representative Nelson, is that when you have a tsunami, a wave that comes in, it is the volume of water simply rises up to accommodate whatever that offset. If you think about it, you take in a pool of water, if you take it and you throw a rock in it, you get those waves that go out, or the ripples that go out. Well, the reason that happens is because you've changed the volume. You've thrown a rock in there. And so you have to accommodate that volume of water. So you'd have to build a wall 50 or 100 feet high all along the coast to deflect the wave, and that's just not realistic. So you have to get up above that volume of water that's going to move in. That's really the only way to evacuate or get. So the evacuation is either get to high ground, if you have high ground and you have time to do it, or make high ground that you can evacuate to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, our daughter was at the beach, I think Cannon Beach, band camp this last weekend. Forgive me for not knowing exactly where she was. I knew I had to be at the high school.
Boy, I remember you.
I had to be at Clackamas High School at 4:30 to pick her up. That's what I knew.
Right now.
Okay, so, you know, I believe it was Cannon Beach. I feel, I'm always talking about it. I kind of like stand a father up. Anyway, we were at Rockaway at my cousin's cabin, and the fire whistle went off in the middle of the night, and I'm not much of a sleeper, and I heard it, and I called down there, and I go, hey, what is that? I got the phone book out, and I go, and they go, that's a fire whistle. And I go, well, I didn't know what it was. I almost woke my wife and daughter up and got in the car and tried to hightail it. So somehow we need a consistent, are all the whistles the same from all the way down the coast? This is the sound for a tsunami. This is the sound for a fire whistle. And if they're not, they should be. So, and as far as your wave height, That's the reason I asked the question. No point in building some building just to have it 3 or 4 feet too small, and next thing you know, you got a wave coming right. And taking everybody out. So those two things, one, the fire whistle versus tsunami warning sound, and the elevation. I'm interested right. In all that stuff. So.
Now, I can answer the whistle.
Okay.
And it's a siren. And if you had been at the meeting in Bend, you would have seen.
We would have loved to.
They don't have a tsunami whistle in Bend, do they?
We had a presentation, actually.
Okay, we'll forgive you
in
that.
In conjunction with the OEMA meeting. But anyway, there are several models for to do that, to have a uniform tsunami okay. siren. In Cannon Beach, they used to have the sound of cows.
Chair Boone and Schaffler, it's not what Cannon Beach has done. Actually, many years ago now, is that they have a siren system, but with a loudspeaker system. Mm-hmm. So
I knew you had.
And the cows, that it was called Coastal Warning System, so they named it cows. And the decision was made early on by the fire district that if they kept signing, you know, having this go off, people wouldn't know if it was a tsunami or not. So outside, with the loudspeaker system, they would have cows mooing, which actually got people's attention just as well because it's so funny. And afterwards,
they don't do it until next.
They after then give an announcement, basically saying this is a warning system and describing what the siren will sound like afterwards. So when a real emergency happens, people know.
And then
it was very, very popular. People did get that. And like I said, I was. Actually, it sounds like a joke, but no, they couldn't get away with that in Tillamook because everybody would just.
Yeah, I got it.
We got it.
So, if I may, Madam Chair, I also, if we know what the elevation of the water is going to be at the high mark, relatively, you know, within, we had to mark that on the telephone poles. We had to mark where it is. So then when I'm driving to the coast, I know where I got to get to if really something bad. And if I hear the cows mooing, I know where I got to go.
May I take that one for you? Chair Boone and Representative Schaffler, we do actually have those marked. Mm-hmm. When you're driving along the coast, you will drive in and out of tsunami zones. This will say you're in the zone. This will say you're leaving the zone. And the same with the evacuation signs.
Madam Chair, if I may, I understand some of those routes led people to elevations that were not high enough to escape the zone. There was something on television, for what it was worth.
The other problem with the signs, just recently found out, at least in South Tillamook County, they're very popular now with people collecting the signs. So they're disappearing. They're going to have to make more.
Okay. Chair Boone and Rep. Schaffler, on two issues. One is that there's a tsunami advisory committee that's made up of coastal elected officials, emergency planners, and other representatives. And that one thing that they're going to actually be looking at is hopefully with Dogami and OEM and ODOT, which is the placement of those signs, because there is a problem with that. It has to do with jurisdictional issues. And there's some famous ones. There's one up at Warrenton, which basically you're leaving the city limits of Warrenton and you're heading out to Young's Bay. So you're clearly not leaving the tsunami inundation zone. In Newport, they actually do have this. I've started this system that you're referring to where they're marking evacuation lines on telephone poles and other things within the city. Oh. So there are a lot of things happening on the Oregon coast in different communities. And
all the hotels efforts. And restaurants have the tsunami. It's like a door hanger. Tells you what to do in case of, and they all reference the siren system or whatever the warning is locally. You'll be fine. You hear that go off in the middle of the night, just have read that, though, when you check in.
My wife will make sure I read it, because she knows I'm paranoid.
Well, don't remember.
It's come a long way, I have to say. I remember the days when people said, no, we don't want to have warnings, because then people will be afraid to come here. And so, but I said, wouldn't it be better to warn them than have them come and be washed away?
Right. That's not very responsible.
Chair Boone and committee, just a quick thank you for the introduction of the legislative concept and the bill, and we'll follow through on that and be happy to provide you with, you know, we'll sit down and work on funding numbers on that again. And if there is an opportunity, I would like to come in and give you a LIDAR update as well, because we have a lot
absolutely
of good news on that.
We haven't decided if this is our last meeting in the interim or not, but we may need one more just in late November to early December. And I'd appreciate that, and I hope that we can get the Olin update at that point, too. Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Dr. McConnell, you know, when we have a recent tornado, what I'm just curious about is when y'all are putting all your data together, I mean, that was very unusual for this part of the world.
Right.
I mean, I grew up in them. So, I mean, is this is there somewhere in your scientific data that you know that more of this is going to happen? I mean, first we were just concerned about Mount St. Helens, earthquakes and tsunamis, but now we're seeming to be adding this. Is there more data that's... Because I know the destruction from tornadoes.
Mm-hmm. I'll answer this in a general... Chair Boone and Representative Nelson, I'll answer this in a general format, in that extreme storms are a concern, and they're certainly something that's identified by OEM as one of the hazards that the state faces. And by extreme storms, I would mean like the extreme wind storm that we had, which was really the tail end of a typhoon in December, the fact that they're, tornadoes occur here. Are we having more than before? I really couldn't answer that. We don't track meteorological data that closely, but there, you know, National Weather Service does and could answer that question.
Thank you. I have friends that, excuse me, I just want to say this. friend that went to Carson City and put a nickel in a machine and won $538,000. Because they won this money, she had believed that Oregon's going to fall into the ocean, so they moved their entire family then to Arkansas.
Really?
Yeah. And then she died, I believe, 4 weeks later of sleep apnea.
Oh, my God.
And her husband remarried quickly.
Wow.
But anyway, I don't
sounds like a good story.
Wow, I guess.
No, but I'm just saying, there is nothing to that, is there? We're not going to fall off the Oregon coast. You're going to fall in the ocean, is it?
Chair Boone and Representative Nelson, not in the literal sense.
Debbie, I'm worried about you over there, you and Jean.
Don't worry about us. I live inland 12 miles.
Okay.
Everybody's coming to my house.
Okay.
Chair Boone and committee, I don't want to steal Mayor Raskin's thunder here. I just wanted to add a little more information. And so, I kind of want to turn it back to if there's any action or anything that you want to discuss with him before you adjourn us here.
Okay.
I just think, Madam Chair, I just think the mayor needs to get on his PR hat, and how you prepare this data for the legislature is very important.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jay, very much. Appreciate you coming over.
Good for all you do.
Good information. Look forward to working with you on this as it develops. Now, we're at a time now where we have public comment. If anybody would like to come forward and...
Madam Chair, I have a public comment I'd like to make.
Okay.
It's my sixth year, and it's been an honor and pleasure to serve with our good friend, Representative Donna Nelson here.
Thank you.
Her heart and her passion and empathy and sense of humor and wonderful sense of fashion have made it far more interesting and colorful and pleasant to be here. And I just wanted to thank you. And I know everyone in the legislature feels the same, that you've just been delightful to work with. And God bless you. And I look, you're not going to be a stranger, though, are you?
Oh, goodness,
you're
no. I've got some bills filed.
Keep guessing. Good. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your public service.
And I would also like to comment on Representative Nelson, and thank you for you're longer than my term in this arena, and all the work that you've done so far and continue to do and will continue to do. And I hope to see you out there sitting next to Ken Murphy and some of our usual suspects that are out in the audience for every meeting, because we'll need your advice and guidance.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'd just like to thank Cindy. Your wonderful committee administrators who keep us organized are just absolutely incredible.
Amen.
And
we try.
And Leslie Boone, it has been a delight to see you grow and take charge, and I feel much safer in my state because of you, because I know your commitment and all you do. And Mike, I tell you, when you speak, it's like E.F. Hutton, you know. And
oh boy,
yeah. But don't quit.
No, not anytime soon.
We need more leaders like y'all, and keep up the good work. And thank you. And Aaron, well, I just want to tell Aaron, I've been able to work with her for a considerable time, and I thank you very much. And especially like to say to Ken Murphy and General Caldwell, what an honor to have such fine leadership here.
Absolutely.
And
we love everybody.
Not everybody.
Well, that's what makes things happen. You know, they believe in what they're doing, so
that's
you
right.
can see it and you sense it, and you want to support them. Then, you know, I want to go out and get him $100,000 tomorrow.
Yep.
For that.
So do I.
Cam
yeah.
Beach. And
he'll take it. We want to. We'll put it on the record too. We want to help OEM beef
exactly.
up a little bit so they can do what they need to do. So
exactly.
with all that said, Mr. Bella, you come forward, please, and welcome. And you know the drill. You have to introduce yourself, et cetera, so we know who it is speaking. He's got the tsunami patch.
My name is James Biela. I'm president and founder of Oregon Earthquake Awareness, and I live in Portland, Oregon.
James Biela. I'm sorry, I mispronounced your name. I apologize.
Representative Nelson, Oregon will not slide into the ocean, but when the tsunami comes, you can kiss your ass story goodbye.
Is that right?
I'm going to comment on, I guess, all the three things, but the first thing I thought on LC 1216, I think this is an error. I think the case for LIDAR mapping has not been made for the statement was made for a credible tsunami modeling. There are, when they model tsunamis, they have to use a grid spacing anyway that doesn't go inch by inch. And I think that's usually 50 maybe meters or so forth. And there's very much uncertainty. There's uncertainty in where the deformation will be on the seafloor. There's uncertainty on whether they'll be slumping near the coast and causing slide-generated waves. So this is, and it's not been stated whether they intend to do the LIDAR mapping through the seawater, which people tell me is possible, but only to certain depths, and depends on how clear the water is. This is, in my view, this is just a ploy to allow the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to reinvent themselves and get some money so they can tell the legislature how important they are. But you should have given.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. Make sure you understand what that bill is. It's really not. It would be Oregon State University has a bathymetric mapping lab. And they map the sea floor. We're not talking LIDAR. It's called something else, and I can't think of the name of it right now. But they do it from small boats. But the LIDAR is the air mapping. Am I right?
So this is the sea beam?
This is the seafloor mapping. It's the bathymetric mapping of the floor of the sea within the 3 miles out from this, from the shore that Oregon has jurisdiction over, and including the near shore area, which is a tough one to do and takes a lot of time. But they have been using and proposed to use out-of-work fishermen and women in smaller boats and take the beam. It's like a, there's several different permutations of how you can do it. And they take a sonar, is it sonar? Yeah. And it will show you the what's on the bottom. In a nutshell, how the bottom is, ups and downs of the bottom of the sea. And that's the piece where if you have that, and you can measure water and you can do a model, say a 15-foot wave will behave like this on this bottom as it comes in and how far it goes up, you know, in the dry land. Can think of it. But that this bill is not a LIDAR mapping bill. It's for seafloor.
Well, in discussions in the last legislative session, it was never clear what the department... the department wanted money for LIDAR, and what the money should be, the money should go to Oregon State University Lab and not be filtered through the State Department of Geology.
And I'll tell you why we did that last time, and we haven't decided how it will go this time, but I'm assuming the same. When money goes through to the university, it goes into their general fund, if you will, the way I understand it. And we wanted to direct this money to the mapping lab just for that purpose and not for availability for other uses, which we all know happens occasionally. Not to say that they do that at OSU, I wouldn't know, but we routed it through Dogami to expedite the process, because part of, not this bill, but part of the whole picture was the LIDAR onshore mapping put together with the bathymetric map. I tell people it's like making chocolate milk. You've got to have the chocolate sauce and the milk to get the chocolate milk. And the chocolate milk in this case is a tsunami model. And so that's what this is. And we wanted to put it through Dogami because they were already doing the onshore piece, and it seemed a better fit to have one contractor, if you will, of the whole project. But that they subcontracted out to OSU to do the bathymetric mapping. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but I'm trying to clarify it here. I know that's a tiny little summary. It doesn't go into much detail.
Well, it would be nice to have more detail when you're actually voting on something so the public has no idea what you're
doing. Well, we know, yeah, and we will. We needed to get it into the process, and we'll be working it, but like we did last time.
Well, I was just going to say, Madam Chair, rarely do you see a draft become a bill exactly as it's written.
It's
so
changes.
I think if we do need to do some definitive data regarding what type of mapping and what system is used, I think you're exactly right, and I thank you for coming forward, because we wouldn't have known that. And so we'll pay attention to that as the bill comes out.
I'd like to go to Leolin. I saw a sign once that said to stamp out and abolish redundancy. And I'm not sure that this is a very redundant system. The thing that troubles me is there's only one frequency. And should someone figure out how to jam that frequency, I just...
Good point.
I don't know. Somebody needs to ask the question, how could it fail? And in 911, for instance, cell phones didn't work, but text messages seemed to work because they have many different routes that they could go. And so people got information on text messages when their cell phone was overloaded. And so I ride a bicycle a lot, and it has more than one spoke, and I kind of like the fact that if a few are missing, I'm still going down the road. And so I kind of actually like the idea of having more towers, partly because In earthquakes, we know that there's a thing called ridgetop shattering, where you get high amplification of the earthquake ground motions, very high shaking at the on the ridges, such that in the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, there were trees that were actually snapped in two. So, and also, if you look at the map down the gorge, or down the boundary, that's area is in the building code, that's a very high wind area. So whenever somebody how do I want to put this, whenever somebody wants to reduce something to just one variable, I become a little nervous, because most of our things in our world are systems. And
good point.
The before I get to the cost, when we have an emergency, it's not going to be at all these places on the same time. And from the OEMA meeting that I went to, I believe there are mobile systems that could come in and park in front of the Capitol and do the technology so that people in the local area could communicate with one another on their different frequency systems. There was a tombstone that Owen Moore has passed away, Owen Moore, and he could pay. And I just don't know that the cost is well, it would be nice, and while it seems to be the fad now, I don't know if 10 years down the line it would be. Yeah, a good example is the Internet. People have found that they can really do a lot of things with the Internet, and they wouldn't need the Owen system to tell people in Washington State or Seattle that we had an earthquake, because the Geological Survey has developed this shake cast, so when the ground shakes, they put out a map over the Internet, shows how strong the shaking was, and it goes to people who sign up. It's automatically sent to utilities and so forth. And during the fires in Southern California last October, I went to the website and I got all the information that the emergency managers were putting out. So, perhaps there's, I guess one point would be perhaps there would be some value in having more towers than fewer towers. We should have a backup system so that somebody can come in mobily. Maybe it's not needed to be used, but somebody needs to show up with a system so that everybody locally, no matter what radio they have, can talk to one another. So we don't put all our bags eggs in the Olin basket. And then on Mr. Murphy's thing on these plans, the thing that's always troubled me about plans is they seem to be done to get reimbursement from FEMA. And I was really agreed with the committees that most of the response has to happen at the local level. In an earthquake, you only have about an hour to pull people out of the wreckage and get them to the hospital, or they'll die of their injuries later. That's pretty well established. So, during the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, the Port of Oakland put three or four people in a room just to do cost accounting for FEMA. So this overriding concern for financial reimbursement, we need to put equal time and effort into the bottom-up thing. And I really recommend you bring the people from Lincoln County who have developed a system. They've got the area mapped out in different areas. A captain is responsible for those areas. They have a LIDAR base map, so they know what the elevation is of all the houses. The LIDAR is very good. It was promoted for floodplain mapping because there were letters of argument when people said, well, I'm not really in the floodplain. And the geography had changed so much that nobody knew what the actual elevation was. So the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences recommended LIDAR for floodplain mapping, primarily to get rid of all this time-consuming letters of argument that says, I'm not in your floodplain, I'm not paying this. So Mr. Caldwell said there's not enough government out there to get to him in 48 to 72 hours. And this was kind of a basic concern. One of the emergency managers from the state of Washington said, we tell people to be ready for 72 hours, but then we have a little, you know, pilly rainfall, and we send out the cavalry. I'm not saying that this was just a case on the Oregon coast, but we condition people on the minor events to government's supposed to be there to help them. You know, I guess if you have a tsunami, the one thing you will need is a bailout. Mm-hmm. On the Cannon Beach thing, I'm a little torn on that. I gave you the website for the guidelines, and the 1960 magnitude 9.5 subduction zone earthquake in Chile, generally the tsunami runoff was, most study it was 10 meters, and in some cases it was 20 meters. So that's generally probably what we can expect, but the Sumatra earthquake, I think it was like 100 feet, so that's a real killer. And like I said, there's so much uncertainty that, you know, if I were there, I'd really get the hell out of town. And I think if we... I don't know. It's we've had such a problem in our state with our building codes division and actually taking earthquake design requirements that are in the national model codes out of that code when Oregon adopts it. And when some of us got the coast upgraded to a higher seismic design level, the division chopped it. At Otter Rock, just north of Newport. So the North Coast was left at a lower design level for almost 8 or 10 years. Mm. And there was a study done in Cannon Beach, and they built a new fire station. They built that to seismic design 4, which was the highest level at that time. And then somebody did a school, and the consultant said, well, the building code says you're in seismic zone 3, so you can build it to seismic zone 3. So we had these two buildings in Cannon Beach within a quarter mile of each other that were different design levels. So because the North Coast has not been a leader in seismic zonation, whereas the South Coast, I know Coos Bay built a new hospital, and that new hospital was built at the higher seismic zone. So I'm kind of torn here because we owe our tsunami awareness really to Al Aya and the people in Cannon Beach. But the people who actually put their money in appropriate building, that was the argument we tried to put forward for the North Coast, was that we need these stronger buildings so that there'll be, people will not have their building collapsing on them so that they can evacuate. So, and I think maybe the final point is that FEMA wants this cost-benefit thing, but I think if we want this structure, that we should just build it and not play the FEMA game.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes. Is it Bella?
Bela, I'm sorry.
Bela. Mr. Bela, are you sound so smart on this. Do you have a geological background?
Yes, I have. Actually, I have a background. I have a master's degree in civil engineering and a master's degree in geology.
Well, thank you for coming. I wrote down your points, and I hope that you'll submit those points to each of the people you talked about today, because my philosophy is nobody's as smart as everybody. And together, you know, we can make something great happen. So, and I appreciate everything you said, and I think that rings true on that redundancy on the radio system, that you need some. And I like everything you said, and I think it's worth listening to and considering. So I appreciate it. I wish we had more concerned individuals like yourself that would come in and give us information from different perspectives. And you waited a long time, and I thank you for it.
If you have 1 minute, I can tell you something about the levee failure in New Orleans. If
I'll stop by. See you.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Bela. And with that, I will close the hearing and thank everybody once again for coming.